I call the regular meeting of Savannah County Board of Supervisors to order. We will begin with Pledge of Allegiance, followed by a moment of silence.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you very much. Okay, now we'll adopt the agenda for the meeting. Are there any recommended changes or other updates? And I believe we have a new business item.
Yes, sir. If you'll entertain it, if you look on your new business under number 11, I added it on the agenda so it'd be written on there. And Mr. Dahl, we need to brief you on water and sewer financing options for the Zion Crossroads system. And there's just some deadlines coming up, so we wanted to give you an update on that and get some feedback from the board. So that's already on your agenda, but on the printed agenda, it wasn't in the agenda that was published last week.
We're not going to have any closed meetings?
No, sir.
Uh-huh. You're not going to bring us up to date on anything that we did at the last closed meeting or anything new developed or anything?
If you want me to, I will.
Well, I just, you know.
Yeah.
It's something left in the air, sorry.
We can. I'm not sure exactly what you mean, but we certainly can. Mr. O'Brien's got the page, and the county attorney and I have talked about it. We didn't have anything particular, but okay. I can certainly update
That's
on anything
right.
from the last couple weeks if you want.
It'd be refreshing not to have one for a change.
Yeah.
That's all right.
Okay.
There's some things pending.
Make it through here and not go, Mr. O'Brien.
Well, and just ask me afterwards, Mr. Weaver, and I'll give you an update, and then I can let the rest know if there's something that was oversight.
All righty. Okay, so do we have the adoption of the agenda with the one added item for new business?
So made.
Second.
All righty, motion made by Mr. O'Brien, seconded by Mr. Weaver. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Chair votes aye. Agenda's been adopted 5-0. County Administrator's report, sir.
So I think there, wrong slide, sorry. I think there are two events coming up. Sometime in the next few days, both Mr. O'Brien and Mr. Weaver are having birthdays going pretty soon. I think Mr. O'Brien's is Friday and Mr. Weaver's is next week.
Can't you? Please forget him.
I'm catching up to him. I'm catching up.
That's what I thought.
You have a long ways to go.
Yeah.
Oh, no.
For about 5 or 6 days, you'll catch up. Anyway, happy birthday to both of you. And I'd like to welcome Mr. Stephen Harvey, who's here tonight. He's the outreach director for Congressman Tom Garrett. Mr. Harvey and I met today. Mr. Harvey, welcome. Thank you for coming to Savannah County. We appreciate you reaching out to us. He's here tonight to observe the board meeting and also just to let everyone know that he's here representing Congressman Garrett, and people can reach out to him if they have any issues or needs as well. So thank you very much. The Pleasant Grove Park had their annual Easter egg hunt. It was pretty crazy, like again, as always. And the Easter Bunny doesn't look near as scary as when I was a kid. That one's pretty nice looking. But they had a great time and lots of children out there and 6,000 pre-filled eggs. And if you know that about the golden egg, there were golden eggs for each of those age groups and heartily fought after. I think there was also an Easter egg hunt at the schools.
No, we did at the community center.
At the community center?
Yeah. Yeah, for the four-year-old.
Oh, great. Okay. So they did one down there. The Earth Day celebration is coming up April 22nd, this Saturday, and that'll be for tire recycling and soil water conservation activities, the tours of the garden and the nature conservation information. We're not doing the hazardous waste this year. That'll be for next year that the board approved on that. So again, Saturday from 10 to 2 at the park. The Old Farm Day is coming May 6th. We've got lots of volunteers from the county staff that have already signed up, but we're looking for more volunteers for any of the time slots to help man the county booth that'll be near the front. And so if any supervisors want to volunteer a few minutes or an hour or two to come volunteer at the county booth that day, we'll be glad to provide donuts and cold water. So. And the Bobcat met good service again, supporting our FUSD folks. They had another late night water repair, and the Bobcat really made all the difference in the world, so it's really earning its keep. And as Wayne says, the FUSD utilities crew always earn their keep. They work pretty hard. So you can see another line break.
Where was that line?
Someplace on the Fork Union Sanitary District system, ma'am. So, Wayne. Sorry. Wayne? Where was it?
Which service?
Social services.
Oh, it was.
Yeah, it was. It's the smaller line coming off of there is actually a 3-inch service line that runs all the way back to the old Thomasville factory. We're considering shortening that service by tying it into the 8-inch line that goes to the elementary school right at the intersection of Carriesbrook Road and 15. But for this particular repair, it needed to be done because the leak was pretty bad.
Okay, thank you.
So thanks again for the Bobcat. It makes a huge difference on all these kinds of repairs. And then just a reminder, your regular meeting's coming up. The only work session that we've got projected is for that projects work session and the Zion Crossroads design discussion. That's on May 17th at 4 p.m. Other than that, it's your regular meetings for May and June. And a reminder, remember, in July, you only have the first meeting of the month, and then there's no second meeting. You'll have the afternoon and evening meeting, the first meeting in July, and then nothing until the first meeting in August for covering for vacations and school.
What day in July is that?
Pardon?
What day in July is that?
Does anybody got a calendar quick? We'll find it.
I may be gone that day.
Okay. Well, we'll put lots
we
of good
check
stuff.
In on the 8th.
We'll put lots of good stuff on the calendar that
morning. Or 9th or 10th, I don't know. I should be okay.
It's the 7th. Yeah. No, I'm sorry.
5th.
5th, yeah. July 5th.
I should be okay.
Okay.
Unless my wife dealt me.
The Wednesday, July 5th. So any questions I can answer for the board?
Any questions? Thank you very much, sir. We do appreciate it. We will now open our first round of public comments. Anyone wishing to address the board should come to the podium and state your name and address. Please remember to keep your comments to 5 minutes on topic and direct it to the board. Is there anyone wishing to speak to the board at this time? One of you young people from over in Coach Pace's class I know wants to come talk to us.
Come on, Savvy Goose, get up there.
All righty, seeing no one, I will now close the first round of public comment. That will take us to public hearing. Next item is tab X, FY17 budget amendment, public hearing. Mr. Collins.
Mr. Chair, members of the board, we're here to have a public hearing for an FY17 budget amendment. This budget amendment stems from the energy project that the board approved back in February. So as we've said before, under Virginia Code Section 15.2-2507, a public hearing is required for any budget amendment greater than 1% of the total expenditures in the current adopted budget. Obviously, with a budget amendment of $7.6 million, that's greater than 1%. The FY17 adopted budget was almost $78.3 million. Currently, the amended FY17 budget before this amendment is $88.1 million, and after this amendment, it would be $95.8 million. So as we said, this budget amendment is due to the energy performance contract that the board approved on February 15, 2017. That contract amount was about $7.4 million. Subsequently, on that evening, the board also approved the financing for the energy project for an amount not to exceed $7.8 million. When everything was all said and done, the project was $7,653,740. So obviously, the budget amendment, we have to recognize both the revenues and the balancing expenses for this amendment. So obviously the revenues come from the issuance of the Virginia Resource Authority taxable qualified energy conservation revenue bond. And then the expenditures in the same amount are broken down on the next slide. So as I said, the top blue line, the $7,398,098, that was the train contract. And then below that, the $255,642, that is the lump sum total of all the costs of issuance. I know Mr. Weaver asked about this at the last meeting when we were talking about if this was all for VRA. This was not, the 255 was not all VRA costs. It's broken out as such. So the largest portion was the Virginia Saves program fee. That's for them to administer the program. It's a 15-year program, so they have due diligence that they have to do every year regarding the federal interest rate subsidy for this project and the program. And then, you know, there's bond council fees and other legal fees as well. So the total expenditures for this came out to $7,653,740. Any questions from the board?
Any question?
No.
Thank you so very much.
And just one final thing. One other question was asked that, you know, we thought that the costs were high going this route. And so this was when the board approved the financing back in February. This chart right here kind of shows a comparison of going the Virginia Saves route versus going the tax exempt route. So if you see...
Well, you're down to 0.91% interest, which is great.
Okay, so if you see right there, so this one right here, this is the financing that the board approved, and this one was the tax exempt. So the effective interest rate for the route that we went was 0.91% versus the other, which was 2.48%. Now, granted, if you look at the total loan proceeds, total proceeds required, it's drastically more with the route that we went, but when you factor in the effective interest rate for the life of the loan, you can see total debt service over the life of the loan was $8,375,000 versus $8.5 million. This number right here includes the interest rate subsidy and any ongoing expenses. And then in addition, the debt service, annual debt service for Virginia Saves financing that we went was $540,000 a year versus $568,000 a year. So I feel that the county got a very good financing option for the program that they're going through. So that's just kind of a look at that financing for that. But I don't really have any other questions or slides unless the board has any questions for me.
None.
It's great that we're doing it.
All righty. Hearing none, we'll open the public hearing. Please keep your comments to 5 minutes on topic and direct it to the board. Anyone wishing to speak, please approach at this time. With no one wishing to speak, we will now close the public hearing. Are there any questions or comments from the board? Do we have a motion?
I move the Board of Supervisors approve at fiscal year 17 budget amendment of $7,653,740 for the issuance of the Virginia Resource Authority taxable qualified energy conservation revenue bond, Virginia Saves Green Community Program, through Vanna County Projects. Series 2017 with $7,398,098 in expenditures for equipment purchasing and project construction funds and $255,642 in expenditures for the cost assurance, increasing the fiscal year 17 amended budget to $95,836,202. Did I slip up on any words?
No, ma'am. You did it really well. I just wanted to do it faster.
That wasn't going to happen faster if it was going to be right. Do we have a second?
Tongue twister.
Second. Please, somebody second. That's what I want to read it again. All right. We have a motion made by Ms. Booker and seconded by Mr. Weaver. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Chair votes aye. Passes 5-0. Young people, I know some of y'all just came in from practice. Stephen, I'll tell you this much. There's a basket sitting right there on the corner. They're absolutely awful. But Mrs. Eager would appreciate it if you ate some of her cookies. Okay? And no, I did not eat three of them just now.
Because they were terrible.
I just didn't want anybody else to... I didn't want to go home feeling bad. All righty. We are now in action matters. Thank you, Mrs. Eager.
Eating your cookies, I guess.
Well, now we'll move to action matters at tab XYZ, Raymond James Contract Addendum for Bidding Agent Services. Mr. Dahl.
Okay, so back in January, we had our financial advisor with Raymond James come out here and present the same slide set for the board, and then we're just kind of going over some of it again. So this is escrow savings opportunity for the high school bonds that were advanced refunded in 2012. So just a little background. So the Series 2012 bonds were advanced refunded. They advanced refunded the Series 2008 bonds. Those were the original high school bonds. Those Series 2012 bond proceeds were invested in certain securities to pay the principal and interest on refunded bonds for the payoff of 12/1/2018. The way that the securities were structured, they did not perfectly align when they matured with when the bonds were when we had to pay for the 12/1 bonds. Due to this misalignment, and if you see down at the bottom here, the way the bonds were, the misalignment was, so on 8/15 we have $54,908,000 of securities that are maturing, and then on 9/15 we have $2.2 million. So we basically have a 105-day period of $54 million, well, almost $55 million of bonds, and then a 75-day period for the $2.2 million of bonds that basically will not be earning any interest. This doesn't happen very often the way this was. It was just when those securities and the maturity dates were structured, it just didn't align, the rules didn't align perfectly at that time. But in hindsight, though, it is providing for the county to get some additional revenue at this point that wasn't foreseen at that time. So just to briefly describe an escrow float contract. An escrow float contract is basically where we're a provider. We pay VPSA and the county a cash payment today for the right to invest those securities maturing on 8/15 and 9/15. And so basically we would get funds up front for allowing those investors and providers to investment in security at their point at that time. Currently, if we were to just pull the trigger today and move forward with the transaction, a current bid would be about $120,000 for this. After expenses that are associated with this, the expenses associated with this would be $46,000. The county would net about $74,000 if we're just talking like as of 4/10. So for an execution plan, so basically what Raymond James would do, they would basically market these. The county would set a net minimum target amount, whatever it is, whether it's $75,000, $100,000, $150,000. Then once that target amount is set, then Raymond James would circulate bids. They would ensure that all the bids would meet all the requirements of the transaction, and the county would then award the bid to the highest bidder. Bond counsel's involved with this as well. So that's one option that the county has, is to do the float agreement. Another option that the county has is that the county can allow VPSA, once those bonds mature on August 15, 2018 and September 19, 2018, they can allow VPSA to invest those securities in something called slugs, which are state and local government security, state and local government series securities. So the pros of doing that is there's reduced cost of implementation, and on the next slide I'll show you kind of what the comparison of costs are. Another pro is it'll allow time for interest rates to hopefully increase from now, for a year and a half from now. One downfall to this, and one con to this, is the county would not receive a cash payment today. Whereas if we went with the bidding agent services and did the float agreement with Raymond James, whenever a bid was awarded for that bidder, and once Rick and James went out and provided the bidding aid and services, we would get a cash payment up front today. But if we went this route on BPSA to purchase the slugs, we would not get that cash payment until 2018, once everything was matured. Another con of doing this transaction is, one, if the interest rates go down, obviously, they're either going to go up or they're going to go down. So you have pros and cons on either side. We're not really sure what the market's going to do a year and a half from now. We can assume what it's going to do, but we're not guaranteed what it's going to do. And then one other con for this is the slugged window does close periodically. And so currently right now, the Treasury closed the window for purchasing these securities on March 15, 2017. So on the next slide, I'll just kind of show you. So since 1995, the window to be able to purchase these securities has closed 12 times. And you can kind of see kind of going down there. The window was closed from March 13, 2015, all the way to November 2nd, 2015. So let's just say that, where we currently are right now, if that holds true, when we wanted to go ahead and purchase these in August or September of 2018, we would not be able to. So whatever opportunities we had to do this at that point would be lost, and there'd be no revenue going this particular route at that point.
So you're saying if they don't open it, it's closed right now?
Yes.
And it's never been closed for 18 months before?
No.
The longest it seems was...
Correct. And like I said, say they opened it back up in, hypothetically, say they opened it up in November this year and say they closed it down in March again. It just depends upon when the windows open and close.
It's so unlikely that the March 15th this year date is going to extend beyond 3, 4, 5, 6 months.
Yeah.
It's unlikely.
Though. Right, yes. Very unlikely.
I mean, if you look at all the other time frames up there.
Yeah, and they normally in the past have not done this every single year, but you can see that they did it in 12, 13, 14, 15, and 17. If they happen to do it again in 18 and run, say, 4 months from, or 5 or 6 months from March to November, then we miss that window for slugs. You could still do
we could still go back and do the float agreement.
Right.
You just
don't know what the market would be then. But it is unlikely that it'll be closed for a longer period of time. But the problem is, 15 they closed, and that if they close for the same time next year, we'd lose the slugs window. That piece.
And not only that, at that point, if we wait until next year to say we go with the float agreement, the likelihood that we're going to get as high bids as we're going to get now, because they're projecting that interest rate environment's going to increase at that point. So that's where the bids come into play.
So if it's closed, our date is August or?
There's one maturity on August 15th mm-hmm. of 2018, and that's the
54 million?
Yeah, the 54 million 908. So that. There's a 105-day float period between August 15, 2018 and December 1st, 2018.
Yeah, but you have to have an agreement in hand before August 15th
yes.
so that then they can hold that $54 million in an investment for the entire 105 days, because that's what they're bidding on, is to be able to use the $54 million invested, and they walk away with some cash, and they pay us for the benefit of doing that. The problem is that August one is pretty close, relatively speaking, to the March date, and if they happen to do the same March date next year and only go March to August or March to even the end of July, we're hosed, because you wouldn't for slugs. We wouldn't be able to do it for slugs. That's just a guess, though. That's just plain old fact. If it's closed, you can't do slugs. If it doesn't close next year, then there's no problem. You can still do the slugs up until that point.
And if we can't do slugs, mm-hmm. Then we
get
could
the slugs.
Do a... Raymond James could then finance.
Yes, you could have them do that this float, but for them to go out and find today, if I say I've got $54 million, you could do something with for 105 days a year and a half from now. There's going to be lots of people coming in with bids because they'll be betting on the market and seeing what's going on. If you wait until say next summer and do the same thing, you won't get near as high a bids because you're
the interest rate environment is going to be known at that point.
Right.
it's going to be more.
We're trying to get somebody to bet on what the market's going to be, and so the more people compete and bet on what the market's going to be versus what the market actually is next year, the more chance you've got to get bigger dollars. Now I'm not suggesting that's not an alternative to wait next year, because it clearly is. It's just, it's kind of a bird in hand versus a two in the bush. It's a guaranteed dollar now, or for a little while now, versus a speculative dollar next year sometime.
Okay, but we're in a situation right now where the interest rates are improving.
Yep.
Yes. But they're still low.
Yes. Yes. But if there's no reason to believe that they're going to go back to 2015 levels.
No, we think it appears likely that there will be some additional rate increases. Now, they said that for several years it didn't happen, but it certainly does seem more likely than now. So if the interest rates go up, the issue is, if you tell somebody on June 1st of next year that you can play with $54 million for 105 days, there won't be as much bidding on those dollars, because people will know exactly what the market is and they'll have other alternatives.
But I was just talking to Eric.
Right.
Why couldn't we do a repo?
And that
we'll have to connect you all with Raymond James to ask, because I'm not sure.
I'm not sure. I know the VPSA, they are very strict in what type of securities that they would allow to be able to do this transaction.
And it'd be really surprising if that were an option and Raymond James hadn't given that to us already. It's probably because the VPSA bonds are not, you're not allowed to do that with VPSA bonds, but we can certainly find out.
But if Raymond James did do a repo for us and it was allowed, their brokerage would be a whole lot less than what they're charging us now.
Yeah, no, I don't disagree. There are other alternatives in the normal world, but these are not normal bonds in the world. So because they're government bonds and because they're restricted out of these pools, there may not be any other options, but we can certainly ask Raymond James and see.
Seems to me we should have that answer, though, making this decision.
Well, I mean,
I don't disagree, Mr. Weaver, but what I'm suggesting is that Raymond James would have given us that alternative if it were legal to do.
We met with our financial advisors.
Maybe not, but I'm assuming that they would have. We'll find out.
Assumptions get you in trouble sometimes.
Yes, they do.
What is?
No one's ever brought it up before.
I know, but
and our financial advisors should do this for a living.
I'm just looking at all the options,
sure,
and the possibilities. I don't want to overlook $10,000 or $20,000 or
no, I don't want you to either, but I also don't want you to miss.
I don't want to miss it.
You're going to either have to have a special meeting to
you
approve.
Can't do
this.
It the next meeting?
Well,
and still do the same thing?
Sure.
Right.
We can
right.
do it the next meeting.
That's true. I'm thinking of the other one that we have to do.
Well, I think you need to have that answer.
I have a slide that shows all the options, and like I said, you know, and then we have another option, too.
I'm sorry. The amount of money that we're potentially gaining now by doing this float is, again, summed up how much?
So as of when they priced it, like, you know, a week ago when we were going through this, they were saying we would potentially get about $120,000.
A net $74,000 to us.
Yeah, but, What does it translate as a benefit if the market goes up 0.25% for us?
Well,
they're not due for another meeting, are they? Within the next 2 weeks?
No. But because we can wait,
right?
Yeah, and if the interest rate market goes up, then 0.25%.
Absolutely.
You know, is $125,000 per year.
Well, so the one thing that we do is so we either wait a second. Let me go to that slide really quick here. Okay, so one. Our options are, and just to kind of go through this, we can kind of jump back. So one is to move forward with the float agreement, and let's just say that the county says we want to move forward with it. We want to get whatever dollars we're going to get today, and that's that. So let's just say, you know, we want the sure thing for $74,000 today. If that's the way that we want to go, the board would approve the float agreement. At the next meeting, I would come back to you with a resolution from Bond Health, which says that we would not finalize this transaction unless we saw net savings of $75,000, $100,000, $150,000, whatever the board wants to set for that resolution amount. So that's one option. Option two is we could move forward with the float agreement and we could watch the market. We could say, well, you know, the board may say we want to see $100,000, but maybe allow some leeway if the financial advisor said, well, you know, maybe we see a turn in the market. If you wait a couple more weeks, you know, you may get more than that. Now, With that, that's a little cut in the edge, because then that kind of puts staff in the position of kind of allowing what is the will of the board. So I would much rather have the board, if they want to go that route, say this is the amount that we want to see.
Yeah, if you're going to do it, go number one and set what your dollar value is.
Yeah.
And you may have to come back and revisit it, but
instead, what's the total term of the bonds?
Instead of the 74,000, we can set.
Yeah. The 74 is if you pulled the trigger today and said we're going to do it today based on today's market, you'd get about 74.
Yes.
We're not suggesting you do that. We're just suggesting that's an alternative. The second alternative is to say, well, we want it to be 125,000 of net gain for the county, or 200,000. Or if you do number two and you just say, okay, let's sign the agreement so they can do it, and we'll just keep watching the market. We'll try to get the best number we can get. There's a little risk there, because we wouldn't be coming back to you to pull the trigger at the last time. I'd rather have you set a number.
Mr. O'Brien, good question.
The total term?
I'm sorry?
The total term for the bonds is?
The total term?
Yeah, term.
105 days for the $54 million bond.
No. I mean, the length of the bonds.
The bonds are 30-year bonds.
These are refunded bonds from 2008 from the original.
To 2036.
December 2018. Okay. We refunded them. Basically, we refinanced them back in 2012. But we set money in escrow for when those bonds mature.
When can we refinance them again?
What's that?
When will we be able to refinance them again?
I would have to move my charges.
The answer is probably never, because you'll probably never have an interest rate that will be better than what we got the last time we did. But there's also increments of times when you can refund these PFSA bonds. So
if I remember correctly, it's not until probably in the mid-2025 to 2030 that we can even do anything with these.
You can only do it at certain times, because that's the way
they generally have call periods. That certain period you cannot do anything with bonds as far as.
Right. But we're selling the bonds, right? This is us selling them.
No. All we're doing is we have securities that we set in there for refunding the original bonds. But because they're maturing earlier than when those bonds are originally due, we just have this about 90-day float period where we're not going to be receiving any interest. Okay.
Yeah. What you did is you took the old bonds and said, these are a too higher interest rate. You refunded those, took out new bonds at higher cost, but a much lower interest rate, so the net cost over time was lower. But now the timing doesn't match up, and so there's really a period where the dollars are just sitting there, not earning anything for us or for anybody else, and we're finding a way to potentially allow someone to use the $54 million for that 105-day period to earn some money, but to accrue some of that money to us. So
we talked about option one, doing it right now. We talked about option two, doing the float agreement, but maybe we set a higher net savings amount that we want to do. Option three is we don't do anything right now. We say, you know, we think we know what the market's doing, and we're going to wait to move forward with one, executing the float agreement, and two, executing the resolution. The only downfall to that is if we think the market's moving in the right direction, well, let's just say to come tomorrow. Let's just say we said, you know, today we don't want to do anything, but come tomorrow, the day after the board meeting, now we decide that we want to move forward with the transaction because interest rates are going gangbusters. Well, now we have to wait another 2 weeks to come back to the board, to one, for them to approve the float agreement, and two, for them to approve a resolution. So there's a timing issue. If the board wants to go forward with the float agreement, then they're better off approving everything now and then determining what that dollar amount is, what that net savings dollar amount is that they want to achieve. Number four, as I said, is we just wait until 2018 when those securities mature and we allow BPSA to purchase the slugs, assuming that the window's open to be able to do so, and if it's not, then we're out of luck. Number five is our research the repurchase option, which we'll look into. Like I said, we can definitely do that, and we can see what the financial advisor and what BPSA's take is on that. And then number six would just be we do nothing and take no action whatsoever. So, you know, we'll see no revenue out of that $55 million sitting idle for about 90 days.
But if you can do a repo, then if it doesn't if the only option is slugs, we need to know that. And if it's not, and we have other options like the repurchase agreement, the brokerage on a repo would be far less than what they're charging us.
Well, and we'll ask. I would be particularly perturbed with Raymond James if that were an option they hadn't given it to us. So I'm assuming, and we'll certainly check with them and brief you at your next meeting, I'm assuming that it's not a legal option with the VPSA bonds. If it is, and they didn't provide that option to us, well,
the VPSA then that's, is very not, specific. That's not good. We'll check into it, but the VPSA is very specific.
Yeah, we'll find out. Motives and all.
Sure. Well, the only reason I'm questioning it all is because these are not just regular commercial securities out there. These are a little different. And some of the government bonds that we're in don't have the same freedom or the same options as others. But we'll find out for Raymond James for sure.
VPSA wants to make sure that whatever securities are being purchased, that it's going to be more on the conservative side.
So we'll find out, and we'll let you know at your next brief, and just have you not vote on this now, and then we'll brief this at your May 3rd.
And just one thing, just to go back to here, so just to show the just so the board understands, number two right here, this is basically a scenario with rates as of 410, and this shows all the costs associated with it. So under the float agreement, for Raymond James to provide bidding services, it's $25,000. There would have to be a verification agent for $3,500. VPSA's bond counsel would charge $10,000 to review all the documents. The county's bond counsel under this transaction would charge $5,000, and then the escrow agent has a fee of $2,500. So that's where the $46,000 comes in. So on here, as we said, as of today, or as of 410, estimated bid $120,000 less the $46,000. That's where the net $74,000 comes in. But if we just said let's just take for instance the slug rates as of that same date of 410, this is what the net gain would be, because we would see total revenue of $134,000. The total costs to do it are lower because basically we don't have the bidding agent services of $25,000. The county's bond council would charge less to do this type of transaction. So the total cost would be $18,500. So the net gain, just saying, like I said, we were pulling the trigger on both of these options available today.
Except you can't do the slugs until November of this year?
You can't do it until basically a year and 6 months from now, until about August of 2018. That's when you can go.
But that's where you're saying if they're locked down and we can't.
Yeah, if the window's closed, then we don't have the option.
Can you email this presentation to us?
Sure.
Okay.
Sure. I think that's really it. And like I said, there's some, and just one, we'll go back to one here too. So just to show you, so for the slugs purchase,
it's the same dollars.
Well, yeah, it's the same dollars. If the rates decrease, 50%, that's what they would go down to. If the rates increase 50%, that's what they would go down to. And then 100%, this is including all costs and everything associated with it. And that's kind of just comparing it if we wanted to pull the trigger today.
We really shouldn't lose anything, though, by waiting 2 weeks, should we? I mean, the time frame is not going to... Otherwise,
we could.
Huh?
We certainly could.
Well, you're saying if the Fed's... take action. They do that every three months, don't they?
If they
so we're not in that time frame, as I recall.
No, the Feds theoretically could come back and meet and lower the rates anytime, but it doesn't seem likely that they're going to lower rates anytime soon. And so we're probably okay. And the slugs sound fantastic. I mean, based on the way the market's going, you'd think you'd want to go that way, certainly over the float. It just is playing...
There's a risk if
it's not open, you won't be able to do it.
So we'll see. Take the risk.
So you're saying 2 weeks could stop us there?
No. Because for the slugs, you wouldn't do it till next year, sir.
Right.
And so what we're worried about is if there is no ability to do the local government series next year because the market is closed, then that option just completely goes away.
If that slugs window is closed, when we need to do the transaction at that point in about August,
we have to do
late July, next. Early August of 2018,
right.
If that window is closed, then we cannot purchase state local government series.
But we'll come back
next. We need
to
find out if there's some other option.
We'll find out. And like I said, the VPSA, as I said, they're very conservative.
We'll find out. If there are any other options that aren't listed here, we'll remind Raymond James we want every option every time.
But are we locking in purchasing anything? Are we locking in the rates going forward or not? I mean,
you've locked in the amount of money you're going to accrue whenever you sign the float agreement with whatever dollar amount you want.
Just for that 105 or whatever period.
Yes, 105. Right?
Yes, they're not going to float it until next year in August.
Right.
But you're locking it in now.
Right.
At betting on a sure dollar rather than a speculative dollar.
They're basically the provider's basically saying we'll give you this dollar now for their right to invest in
that. Because they think they're going to make more than that.
And then
of course they do.
Whenever we are actually selling them again in August, whatever the market is at that point in time.
Yeah, whatever. That's pure speculation on their part.
Well, we're not locking in a rate for those bonds prior to that. Right?
No, we don't care what they sell for.
Right. Okay.
If you do the float agreement and you say a specific amount, we don't care what they sell for. We don't care if they make money or don't make money because they've already required to pay us whatever money
we
was
have
committed.
Our securities. So when 12-1 comes, we've got the securities to pay off those original bonds.
Sure.
Like I said, it's looking at do we want to get some type of funding in today's dollars, you know, whether it's in, you know, today, tomorrow, a month from now, or do we want to risk it in like a year and 6 months from now, and it could go up and could go down, or if the slugs is the only other option we have, and if the window's closed, then we get nothing.
Well, you could then float it. In
we could float it at
August
that point, and
of 18.
We would see what that bid we would get. At
right.
That point. I don't think it would be. As
and it could be.
But you don't know that, and I don't think that Raymond James would be willing to make this float agreement now if they didn't think that they would that the rates are going to be much higher, because that's how they're going to make more money on us.
Well, the provider who's ever bidding on this, that's where they're going to make more money.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Raymond James. If Raymond James is trying to make money, and they thought they'd make more money next July, they'd be proposing next July. They're looking to maximize the county's dollars at the least risk. That's why the whole list of options there. The least risk upfront one is the float agreement because it's a guarantee. It doesn't mean it's the right one to do. I'm just suggesting that it's the least risk
the
guaranteed
safe.
Amount. Right.
Okay.
It's the safe amount, and it's somewhat of a known amount in today's market.
Well, it's an absolute known amount because whatever dollars you set, as long as they achieve that, then you're going to get that amount. They may achieve more than that, and or they may get a better buy, but you would be setting a minimum amount before they could do it. But we'll check on those other alternatives and then come back and brief. And again, if there are other alternatives that aren't listed here, then that's a problem.
And then we can make a decision next board meeting on this.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Yeah.
And it may very well be that if historically the dates that Eric showed you on the slug opportunities, it's not terribly likely that it's going to be closed all the way up through the end of July. But there certainly have been through the end, but I mean if they open it back up now and then close next year.
Sure.
The problem is you can't do the slugs.
Until
now,
we can't do that until August 15th and September.
Before that, right?
Yeah,
right.
A little before that.
Right.
Have everything
so if
set up.
If they like next year, if they close again in March and they close from March to July, then we missed that opportunity. It doesn't mean you still couldn't do a float, but by that time you're not going to get much on the float because it's what people are betting on now is speculation and stuff.
Well.
Right.
Mm-hmm. It's going to be known at that point. And just one thing, just to make the board aware of, the only reason we are doing the bidding agent contract in this meeting and the resolution at the next meeting is because we don't want, so if we go forward with the bidding agent services, there's going to be bond council cost to create the resolution. So until we know that the board wants to go forward with the float agreement, I don't want to get our bond council starting to start rolling on legal costs. So then, know, if we bring this back to you at the next meeting, then the resolution would be at the meeting after that until we know which direction the board wants to go.
Okay.
Great, thanks.
All righty, we will now move to the action matters at tab A.
So I'm just going to mark that one deferred.
To the James River Water Authority. Mr. Nichols.
I'm just going to mark that previous one deferred as far as the vote, and we'll defer it until May 3rd. Yep. This is just a reappointment. There are no other candidates for this position. Mr. Dunning, who's a current member of the James River Water Authority from Savannah County, is requesting reappointment. His reappointment is due now.
He seems very qualified.
He's fantastic. More eminently qualified than I am to be on the JRWA, and he's been really good as a member of the board.
Okay, with that, I'd like to move to appoint.
Reappoint
Charles Mark Dunning to the James River Water Authority citizen representative position with a term to begin 4/19/2017 and to terminate April 18th, 2021.
Second. Motion's made by Ms. Eager, seconded by Mr. Weaver. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Chair votes aye. Motion passes 5-0. We will now move to tab B, appointment to the Java Board of Directors.
And this is to replace, unfortunately, Mr. Hughes, who passed away last fall. And the person who's requesting appointment already serves on the Java Advisory Council as an at-large member. This is Paul Bevins, to serve on the Java Board of Directors.
I move to appoint Mr. Paul Bevins to the Jefferson Area Board of Asian Java.
Second.
Board of Directors, replacing William Hughes, with the term begins April 19, 2017, terminate June 30, 2019.
Second.
Motion made by Ms. Booker, seconded by Mr. O'Brien. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Chair votes aye. Motion passes 5-0. And we will now move to tab C, an agreement between FSPCA and the County of Fluvanna for the provision of public animal shelter services. Mr. Nichols.
So, Mr. Chair, members of the board, just whoever reads the motion, if you get to the motion, just read the one off the screen, please. I've just added some extra language at the end there. But you all have been briefed multiple times about the negotiations with the Fluvanna Society for Prevention of Cruelty to Animals. They have been our pound services provider, public animal shelter services provider, for a number of years. The last time the contract was negotiated was in 2012. We worked this spring with the Sheriff's Office, County Attorney, myself, and other staff members to work with the FSPCA board to renegotiate the contract. What I want to show you is the in your package is the new document and the red line of the old document. Red line's hard to look at because there's 1,000 changes to it. But if you look at, if you look at this document, just the highlights here on what changed, I think, are maybe the most important things. So the initial agreement is a 24-month term now with initial 1-year agreement renewals after that, automatic renewals unless action is taken by either party. And so it's a 5-year agreement, 2 years plus 3 1-year additions. The termination clause is 12 months prior with prior written notice, gives both parties time to accommodate any specific change. The county funding increases from $5 per capita to $6 per capita. You already budgeted for that in your budget, so it's a $25,691 increase. And that we haven't had a change since 2012, so this is an increase to the existing $128,000 that we pay. The FSPCA, we also have provisions there now where the FSPCA would reimburse the county for the cost of certain repairs over $1,000 if they terminate the contract, or if the contract is ended for some reason, where we've been providing facility services for those higher cost items. And then maybe the most important agreement here is the spay and neuter services and microchip services for all the public shelter animals, unless otherwise dictated by a licensed veterinarian. But that's a really good thing for the County of Fluvanna, for our residents, to have stray animals spayed, neutered, and microchipped, spayed or neutered and microchipped before they leave for adoption. And the additional funding really helps cover that to make sure that it's done, and it's a good guarantee. The Sheriff's Office has been involved in this, as I said, the County Attorney, the Animal Control, my staff, and myself. And then we have representatives here tonight from the FSPCA board that would like to address any questions you have and maybe talk a little bit about the process as well. So if you want to entertain them to discuss. But those are the substantive changes in there. Largely everything else were administrative changes that both sides agreed on, and this is the final document for your consideration.
Okay, do we have any questions from anyone?
Is there any concern about the amount of funding meeting the ability to spay and neuter all the animals and microchip them?
Is there any concern?
Yeah, I mean, is the funding sufficient?
No, this is the funding amount agreed to by the FSPCA board that would allow them. We had originally proposed $550 per capita, and they said they didn't think they would be able to, and they gave us a variety of charts and tables back that said they didn't think they would be able to do, you know, full spay and neuter services for all public animal shelter animals and the microchipping without really achieving that $6 per capita. And the $6 per capita is kind of right in the middle of what the counties around us pay for public animal shelter services. I think the lowest was ours, $5 per capita, and they go up to about $12 per capita, I believe. And with the $6, we'll be kind of in the middle because there's a couple that are still like at $5.50, $5.75, some that are at $8, and I think one that I think is at $12.
So. Where's the $12? Remember?
If you want to know, I can pull it up. It just took me a second.
I'm just curious where they're up that high.
Maybe in the meantime, maybe you want to hear from the FSPCA board members, and I'll pull it up and look quick. I can pull it up.
Did anyone have any questions for the FSPCA?
I have one. Susie, are you the representative?
I'm Linda.
Okay.
Linda, you can come up too. She needs help.
Yeah. No. Will
feral cats be, can they be trapped and brought in and spayed or neutered?
That was one thing that was brought up in the discussions, and I believe the way we left it was that if the county was going to provide a trap and that the animal control person would be the one that would move them from the trap to the cage and so forth. Another thing we talked about was the possibility of providing rabies vaccinations for staff, but we checked into that, and that is anywhere from like $250 to $300 and something, but we're still looking at that to see. But that was brought up on the feral cat trapping.
Short answer is no.
Okay, because
feral cats are excluded from the pound services.
Because I have a bunch of feral cats on my farm, and I rounded up 17 and took them to Charlottesville's SPCA.
We like that.
They are kind
Some
enough to
do
this
service. Then don't complain when we have tires show up.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah, make sure you check the license on the tires. So.
Yeah, and it was a charge of $5 because they feel it's the less cats having kittens, the better.
So.
And then they clip their ear so they you can tell that they've been spayed.
Please don't clip my ear.
Yeah.
Is there a waiting period between when the animal's first brought in and when it's neutered or spayed?
That depends on the ages of the animals. Remember, you go to the ops meeting on the shelter committee. It also depends on the health of the animal as well as the age. And we have spayed and neutered all of the cats because we felt that was the biggest thing. We did have to make some decisions on some of the dogs, but they have to be, it's in the agreement with the shelter when they're adopted, that they must have been spayed or neutered within a specific time. And if we don't hear back, then that puts a little more work on us to try to be in contact with them and see that that's done. And that was because of the high cost and the fact that it was getting almost impossible to cover all the costs.
But isn't there perhaps some concern if you, say, spay or neuter a purebred dog that was trapped and the owner hasn't found them and you've done that in advance of a couple of weeks? Wouldn't that be a potential concern? Excuse me? There's a period of 10 days. Okay.
And if somebody has a purebred dog that they haven't checked on, tried to find in 10 days, it's probably a good idea to take care of it.
They're not looking.
Well, they might have strayed a long way, and they're not looking in that area, you know. So
possible.
If somebody lost it somewhere else.
Yeah, there are some that travel cross country at these crates. And Mr. Weaver, on the screen, there's the comparison across various localities, the far right column.
Gucci 14 and Orange is 12. That's one of the new pounds.
Yeah, they have a brand new facility they built at a cost of $2 million plus, and so that may be built into the cost. That's why this is a good agreement to not have to build a new public animal shelter facility in Stafford.
Very good.
Thank you so much, Ms. Morris. Any other questions for Ms. Morris? Thank you, ma'am.
I'd just like to thank all of you for being so supportive and encouraging. As new board members worked over the last 2 years and about 4 months at trying to make the facility the best that it can be, and I thank the county for partnering with us and listening, and everyone, it takes everyone's efforts. It takes the community's efforts, and I think that the community and the county and the SPCA all are in favor of the spay neuter and the microchipping, because that ensures a safer community. It ensures fewer numbers, we're hoping, and our numbers are down now, but of course, kitten season, hasn't come. But normally, we look at 150 to 160 animals in the shelter or in foster homes, and right now, our numbers are 62, and 23 of those are in foster care, and 10 of those 23 in foster care are on trial adoption. So we do have that as an option now with the fosters, and quite often the fosters do adopt the animals that they foster. And I really hope that with your support and this agreement, our plan is to not disappoint you. In fact, we're hoping to exceed your expectations. And we're lucky enough to have 6 new board members. Some of those one of them came from the Blue Animal Leadership Program, and I just saw a volunteer I talked to yesterday at the shelter, whose husband was in that program. And even though we've had more volunteers and more fosters, we can always use more. And I just am very pleased that over this last 2 years or so that things have really turned around, and that I feel and we feel that we have so much to be pleased with, but there's always work to be done, and all of us know that, and we will always be striving to make the best better.
Thank you.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you.
Thank you so very much.
Absolutely.
I think I remember that face right there from that leadership development class when I was driving the bus.
And you missed it.
I know. I missed your presentation, ma'am. I had a baseball game that night. I apologize.
I'll have to catch you one day and let you see your name was in it, too.
Yes, ma'am. Please don't let it say something bad about being in Spanish class. No. All right.
I move to approve. I move to approve the document entitled An Agreement Between Flavanna County Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals and the County of Flavanna, Virginia, County of Flavanna, Virginia, for the provision of public animal shelter services as presented, and hereby authorize the county administrator to execute the agreement subject to county attorney approval as to form.
Second.
Motion made by Mr. O'Brien, seconded by Ms. Seeger. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Chair votes aye. Motion passes 5-0, and we'll now move forward with presentations. Oh, man. At tab D, Community Health Improvement Plan, Dr. Denise Bonds, Director of Thomas Jefferson Health District.
So, good evening. I'm pleased to be here. We've actually talked about this plan in its draft form back in November, I believe. So I'm going to present a little bit of different data and go over quickly some of the parts that we've already seen. But please stop me if you have any. There we go.
Right hand.
Okay, so as I've shown before, this is the framework that we use for the health improvement plan. We have our core group, our locality councils in each of the locations, and then the leadership council. Ms. Booker was kind enough to help and serve on this group to assist us over the entire time. We use the Mobilizing for Action Through Planning and Partnerships framework. This is four different assessments that we do over the course of the year: the community themes and strengths, the local public health system assessment, forces of change, and then the community health status assessment. And I would just like to say again that while I'm here representing this health improvement plan, I am merely representing. This is definitely not a health department plan. We had over 100 community partners and 10 community coalitions, so it truly is a community health improvement plan designed by the community. I'd also like to say that it is a living document, and so over the next 3 years, I certainly expect it to change somewhat as we move forward and try and implement the plan. I'd like to acknowledge the agencies and individuals that worked here in Fluvanna. You can see that we had really a robust involvement of all of the different agencies that work here in this county, and they were really active participants. So the community health assessment, we looked at over 140 data indicators. As Ms. Booker knows, that took tons and tons of time, but really was quite interesting. I just showed two representative ones. I think it's always good to see how the population is changing. So your population is increasing slightly from 2010 to 2014, and I think that just represents the recognition that Fluvanna really is a lovely and wonderful place to live. Like many of the surrounding areas, the population is somewhat age heavier, more population in the older age groups. I got it out. It's not quite as weighted towards the very elderly and retirement age, again, as some of our surrounding. And there is a large number of individuals with children in the area, which I think is just recognition of the excellent school system that you have here. The community themes and strengths, this is where we went out and actually asked citizens in the community what made their community a healthy place to live and what they thought the community should improve. We had about 400 individuals, if I do my math, that responded to either an in-person survey, filled out a paper survey at one of the partner locations, or completed the survey online. And this is actually, 400 doesn't seem like a lot for your population, but in fact, for those of us that often work in surveys, this is a pretty robust response. So here is what they thought was a strength and an area that they thought should be improved. The outdoors wins by a landslide in what is felt to be a strength, and I think that we just need to walk outside and look at the beautiful area and the beautiful surroundings to really recognize that. Recreation was also really a strong one, as well as healthcare and safe streets. Things that they thought should be improved in our area, children and youth services, really was an area that many of the citizens felt, and as you can see, adds up to more than 400, so individuals could add more than one, or select more than one. Aging services was also an area that they felt more work needed to be done, as well as transportation. That's not surprising, rural areas. It's often difficult for people to get around if they don't have a car or cannot drive. And then mental health services and obesity. So the council came up with their priority recommendations based on all of the data that they saw, as well as what your citizens said. And you can see that the Fluvanna Local Council thought that mental health was an area that really needed some focus and should be a priority. Housing was also felt to be an issue in the community, and although that's not on the district-wide community health improvement plan, I do want to recognize that individuals in your community feel like housing is a focus area. Having a difficult health system to navigate, I think we can all agree with that one. Interestingly, lack of recreation was also something that the council, so although you have a beautiful and lovely outdoor, perhaps thinking about are there organized or other formal recreation facilities, maybe something, and then economic development. So again, these were the things the council thought should be on the priority. So here are the four priority areas for our health improvement plan over the next 3 to 4 years. Healthy eating and active living, mental health and substance abuse. These are both areas that we have been working on and will continue to work on. Health disparities and access to care and healthy connected communities are two new areas that we'll be focusing on. So I just wanted to point out, I think it's good to see where we've been. As I said, healthy eating and active living was an area, and that was really focused on reducing obesity. And that, as I said, has been an area that we focused on. In 2012 health improvement plan, one of the objectives was to stop the trend of the percentage of residents in our district who are overweight or obese. And it was really focusing on schools and wellness policies, and then employers and wellness programs. And you can see in these lines the the red line, the red line is the Thomas Jefferson Health District, and you can see we've had a gradual increase. We are below Virginia's obesity rate right now. I will say that, and we're below the 2020 goals. This is based on a pretty small data sample size. The behavioral risk factor surveillance is a telephone survey, which is why I can only give you this data at the district level, and it's a pretty small. So. Well, I think this is close to what it is. It's probably not the absolute final number.
I'm sorry. Then that previous slide, the dates were 2000.
This is right. So there's two different slides here, and that's because this survey instrument changed its methodology in 2010, 2011. And so I can't combine the two. It's rolling three-year averages, and that's to help smooth out data from if you're interviewing a small number of individuals and you have one who is a huge outlier, in any one year that can skew the rates pretty significantly. And so to smooth that data and to avoid having those huge outliers, we use rolling rates. That is, we take 3 years of data and we average the data across that time. So that's why. So the last date that I have is 2014. And that's also a problem because I can't get data from local sources. So we're exploring options of trying to get data from our hospitals, but there's lots of privacy concerns in getting that, so I'm relying on these national surveys, and by the time they get the data and clean the data and then get it back out to us, we have about a 2 to 3 year lag. Mm-hmm. So it's unfortunate, but it's the best we can do at this point. But know that we are working on this. The other objective in the 2012 was to reduce the percentage of adults who were physically inactive, and here, a lower number is better. We want people to be active, and we are seeing a slight change in the trend here. I think there's still an area of improvement here. This is essentially a quarter of our population don't do any recreational activities on any basis. So here are the goals, objectives, and Fluvanna strategies for the healthy eating and active living. You can see that the three objectives are really focused on decreasing the percentage of adults and children who are overweight or obese. And then our third objective really is, as I've said, we're trying to get better data across the lifespan. And we're currently in the process of exploring ways to do that. This year, each locality made their own strategies, and Fluvanna strategies are listed here. They chose four for this particular health objective. I think the first one is a really achievable one. They just want an outdoor basketball court that could be used by all community members. And I think that's a great one and something that we can really focus on in the short term. Cooking classes or demonstrations to help people cook healthy meals. increasing awareness of free health resources, and then identifying evidence-based programmings that might address healthy eating, heart health in faith-based settings. So the other health priority that I said was a continuation of our previous was the mental health, that was mental health and substance abuse, and here the 2012 objective was by this year to increase access to mental health services across the entire district by increasing the service hours provided by the community mental health and wellness coalition agencies. And you can see here that individual psychiatric services, group service, not group services, but total services all went up between fiscal year 14 and 15. So the community mental health and wellness coalition members have really recognized this and stepped up to the plate to increase the number of hours available. Unfortunately for the citizens of Fluvanna, all of the members of the community mental health and wellness coalition are centered in the Charlottesville area. And so while Fluvanna residents could go and access them, there is the barrier of transportation to get to, and that's really it.
Region, but how about Region 10 services that are here?
Region 10 would be a member of this, so I take that back. They would, and they are included as part of this, but it's also the Women's Initiative on our own. It's several other services. So, for all of the counties in this planning district, with the exception of the city of Charlottesville, the number of mental health care providers is really inadequate. And that's not a problem unique to us. That's a problem across the entire state and nation. Another objective in the 2012 plan, just to show you, is working on decreasing stigma and fears associated with mental health. So one of the strategies here was to increase the number of individuals going through the mental health first aid program. This is done by Region 10 in our community. And you can see there were a large number of individuals in both fiscal year 14 and 16 that did this training. It's a training that we put all of the staff members in the health department through. I think it's a really valuable training to help individuals understand what mental health problems are and what they can do as a lay individual when a family member or friend is confronted with a mental health problem. It's a fairly inexpensive program, and I'm sure Region 10 would be delighted to do that training for any group here in the county. So here are the objectives for the 2016 Health Improvement Plan regarding mental health. We're really going to continue to focus on increasing upstream services so that we have fewer hospitalizations, increasing the capacity, and then trying to implement policy, system, and environmental changes to prevent substance use disorders and promote mental health. Fluvanna chose three strategies to create some adult peer support groups for addiction, to participate in the Community Mental Health and Wellness Coalition so that they could get better access to the resources and information, and then to try and increase service system capacity by bringing in psychiatrists or psychiatric nurses. So these are great strategies. I think that certainly strategy two is one that I would hope that some members of the community would join and participate in that coalition. So new areas that we'd be focusing on, the improving health disparities increasing access to care. We have three objectives. Because this is a new area for us, our objectives are fairly modest. We really are going to just start by trying to figure out which three health conditions we want to focus on for the next 3 years. We are going to continue to work on the differential in infant mortality between African American infants and white infants. That's an area we have been focusing on in the past and will continue to focus on. And then we're going to try as a group to support employers and community partners who want to work on workforce diversity and cultural awareness. Fluvanna's chosen two strategies. The first is to participate in a coalition that is currently in the process of being structured and undergoing development. And the second is really focusing on the awareness that if you're a Medicaid patient, you have access to medical transportation to and from medical appointments. And so that really would help some of the citizens of Fluvanna get to their appointments that are most likely located in Charlottesville or Altamar. The final health priority is also a new one, the foster a healthy and connected community. Here we're focusing on child and adult abuse and neglect, strengthening healthy relationships, and then decreasing the rate of unintentional injury due to falls. Again, FlipAdvantage has three strategies. I'm trying to work with the faith community to develop a coalition to help and support the community needs. The second strategy, develop a faith aid so that the community could come together to talk about health and social issues. And then the final is perhaps developing a handout about parenting skills and resources for parents that they would get when their children enter schools. So those were our four health priorities. The full report, I've given you the link here. Yeah, data slides are there, so there's lots and lots of data, and you are, everyone is welcome to go to the Health Department website. You can use any of those data slides for any presentation, any need that you will. We will have some hard copies. They're in the process of finalizing and getting printed, and I'll make sure that you all get a copy of a hard copy. And Putnam Ivy is leading this effort at the Health Department, and she would be happy to liaise with any individual. So I'd be happy to answer any questions.
I bought some of these for them, and I also bought the poster that I have displayed in certain places that outlines, and I have several of these which I'll be distributing, but this is just to help you all put these in your
history.
And some I can put in.
And if anybody needs additional posters or more little hand cards, we can be sure and get those to you as well. Mm-hmm. We've got some more in the Health Department.
And the basketball court, I think that Aaron, you talked with Jackie Martin.
Yeah, I've been working on it.
Okay.
Jackie Martin is the community outreach person for Centura and Martha Jefferson, and they have some funds, and I think that it's proceeding.
They have some, but I don't think they have enough to build a brand new basketball.
Right.
That's
a problem. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you
so very much.
Thank you.
We do appreciate it. Next is tab E, Fire and Rescue Update, Ms. Elliott.
Good evening, Mr. Chair and members of the board. With me this evening, I just wanted to point out a couple of people that if there's questions that I can't answer, that I have some more experts in the audience. We have John Mai, who is the assistant chief for Lake Monticello Rescue. He is also the chief for Water Rescue, and he is the president of the Fire and Rescue Association. And we have Chief Mike Brent, who is our county fire chief. And I also have, Michael Grandstaff, who is the director of the 911 center, because we're going to be talking a little bit about data and how calls are dispatched. And so if there's some additional questions, he can tell us a little better about how that all functions in his domain.
Next time, compress the pictures.
Oh. It's probably the 30-minute video I put in there.
Next.
Okay, great, thanks.
Finally, some takers, I'm telling you guys. You ain't doing wrong in that basket. You can't go wrong.
Are they low calorie?
He's already graduated. He knows how to do stuff.
Little McGee just got away from the track meet. I know where she's been.
Is it low calorie cookies?
No.
Okay, we just talked about obesity in FlipAdvantage County.
I certainly hope not.
But if you eat two of them, you'll be balanced because there'll be one for each hip.
Oh, God, I ate three. I'm in trouble. I'm going to lean one way or the other.
As long as there's one every 2 weeks.
All right, Ms. Wilkins.
All right. Here's a summary of what I'm going to go over with. And there's a lot of material I'd like to go over with, so I want to try to do it in a fast speed, but also just some overview things. There's a number of things that we're going to be covering tonight that we will be coming back to you later with more detail on them. So first, what the data is showing. The data that I'm going to show you tonight is from dispatch, and this is related to the calls that fire and rescue have been dispatched to and have responded. Our fire calls are answered 100% by volunteers, and the chart the pie chart there shows who answers the fire calls. So the lake and Lake Monticello and Palmyra Fire are neck and neck for the lead for who gets out the most often. And then Fork Union at 24% of the time, and Kent Store at 9%. Now, that doesn't mean that they only get out 9% of the time. Mm-hmm. That means they answer, of all of the calls that come in, 9% are answered by Fork Union, or I mean Kent Store, for example. And then the other chart there shows time of day. Most of the calls are the red there. I guess it doesn't look real red there, but it's the red is the fire calls. The blue, I'm sorry, the orange is the daylight, and then you have evening and night. So most of our calls are in the daytime or early evening. We answer, fire companies are dispatched to calls that are fire-related, structure fires, automobile accidents, things that are fire-related. Also, first responder calls. There's a certain number of calls that are automatically first responders are dispatched to, like cardiacs, difficulty breathing, seizures, I think children, infants are also included on that. It's where time is really of an essence to get response there. And so first responders are dispatched ahead of, at the same time as the ambulance, but sometimes there can be delayed response for the ambulance to get there. And it's really paramount for those first responders to get there. And then they also can assist with additional manpower. Like in a cardiac, if there's an active CPR going on, then you have the extra manpower right away. And this just shows each company, and the red is their fire calls, and the blue represents how many EMS calls that they take, in this case, it would be first responder. The fire department does not transport, so they would only treat on scene. And then the orange in there are the mutual aid calls. This data I thought was particularly interesting to look at which vehicles respond to the fire calls. And I think where this is going to be even more helpful is as we're looking at fleet maintenance and replacing the fleet. And if you'll notice in the bottom chart on the left-hand side, the brush trucks all evenly go out on the calls between the four companies, but the Lake Monticello brush truck actually gets out a little more often than the other brush trucks. And you agreed to replace brush 50 was up for replacement, and we did that, and it will be put into the CIP Lake Monticello's vehicles from here on out is what we're planning. It also shows that for Fork Union, the vehicle that gets out most often is a car or a support car, and also in the CIP, car 20 is being replaced. So that is actually the vehicle they use most or most often. Both Palmyra and the Lake they get engines out. Tankers, there is only one ladder truck, so that that's why there's only one bar there. And the specialty area is the hazmat trailers and the UTV, used very infrequently, but when it is, it's a critical use. The POV means personal vehicle, and those numbers, there's only one in on a call. There may be 20 people that respond in their own vehicle, but the way dispatch is set up, it only marks one for that particular call. But in that case, you can see how often that each of the fire companies have people respond directly from home to the scene rather than going and getting the vehicles and going forward. What types of calls does fire take? I've divided these out in the red are fire-related calls, and the blue would be the EMS or first responder type calls. And there's only 85% of the calls that are in this chart. The other 15 are like one or two calls that you might have for a suspicious incident or some things that are less common and less frequent. Motor vehicle accidents are the number one thing that the fire department responds to, then brush fires, smoke investigations, and then structure fires. Fall, I'll get to the EMS a little bit later. And these, again, are high-frequency calls. We do have, we are very proud to have a water rescue team in the county, too. And this, in the numbers that I'm showing you are all in this current fiscal year to date. So it's just about nine months of data. But so far, we've had 11 or 6 incidents for water where water rescue responded, and they had 11 pieces of apparatus. An apparatus can, Company 2 may respond with an engine and a support car, so on one call. So it's not a one-to-one thing. That's why the numbers on the apparatus was up a little higher, because they often do respond with more than one vehicle, depending on what the need is. And the same with water rescue, because they have several different resources that they can deploy. And they respond within county, but also out. They are a regional team. Moving then to rescue, EMS calls are answered by volunteers at Lake Monticello, volunteers of Blue Banner Rescue, and also our contract crew, Medic 5. Right now, we have Lake Monticello has about 89 volunteers. Blue Banner Rescue, I think, is right around a dozen. And they are primarily running Friday nights, and they run with the Medic 5 crew right now out of Palmyra, which I think really does help build the camaraderie and to be able to work together. They do their especially the new recruits have to be the medics have to sign off on their on them before they can run on their own, and so having that opportunity to work alongside the medic crew I think is a really good thing. The lake runs about 52%, and Station 1 runs about 45%. And the volunteers are currently running about 2% of the calls. But again, it's about fairly consistently on Friday evenings that they have crews. Time of day, which is kind of interesting, the Station 1 runs most of their times, almost 70% during the day. And if you add the evening hours, it's 88% is during the daytime, and then the volunteers run a little more often in the nights. One of the issues that we've been having is with the whole reason we had to get Medic 5 in place was because the Blue Banner Rescue volunteer numbers were going down. The lake also is experiencing a decline in volunteers. I said they have 89 on their roster, but getting the crews so that they can run consistently is just difficult, with busy schedules, and a lot of our volunteers are aging, and they're wanting to retire for good. So that is an issue, and we have been having a number of days where we do not have complete crews at Lake Monticello, so that it causes dispatch to have to call for more, or if there's a driver on already but no EMT, so they have to tone multiple times to try to get a full crew together, or Medic 5 has to take that call as a first due. And that can be where you run into issues is where some days are just back-to-back calls. And if you don't, the medic crew may be running, they get to the hospital as fast as they can and then get back and there's another pending call. And if we can't get a volunteer crew, then it has to go to mutual aid. And I don't have, we don't really keep numbers on how many times this is happening, but it's happening fairly often. But we are working I'll talk a little bit more about some of the training that we're working on and to fix this situation, because if it goes unchecked, we will have to consider adding another crew. And whether it's another contract crew that's a partial shift, like a 10 to 3, if that's when our numbers look like the numbers are the highest when we need additional crews. I don't think that there's a need right now to add a full 12-hour shift. But we'll wait until our numbers show us that's a little bit more, that's more of a necessity, and then obviously we would come back for your approval on that. I do have some data from Medic 5, and this data is for last calendar year. And I'm sorry, you can't read that as well. They're showing that their day shift is a little bit less than what I was showing in those numbers. But the middle graph there with the line shows how the hour of the day. So they're most in the middle of the day, 9 till 3 is about where the most of their calls are, the height of their calls are coming. Which is kind of interesting. They're showing 70% of their calls are transported. We were estimating for cost recovery that about 75% of calls would be transported, and that's how we guesstimated what kind of income we would see from the cost recovery program. So this is actually showing that they're transporting around 70%.
But is the percent of the calls down?
Right, so 75%.
I understand that's down, but the number of calls. Is that up or?
It's about the same. We're still running about 2,600 calls a year. I think it's about right in there. It kind of fluctuates a little bit, but it's right around that. And about 1,800 fire calls. The interesting thing here that they track are the average time from the shoot time for when the call comes in until they get out is about 2.5 minutes. And they have an average response of about 13, 14 minutes to anywhere in the county, which is interesting when I show you a little a slide or two later, the map of where they respond to. They're on scene only about 16 minutes, and then it's usually about a 35-minute ride into the hospital, and it takes them less than a half an hour to turn around and get back to the county with all the paperwork that they would have to do at the hospital in order to get back. So that's actually really, really good. Here's the map, and this is just Medic 5's response locations, and it doesn't show repeats. So if they went to someplace, we have a couple, we do have a couple of, jokingly refer to them as repeat offenders, but there are some people that call a little more often. There's been a couple of cases that we've actually talked with social services because we think it may be more of a social services issue rather than a medical issue. So there are some other options because when they transfer these calls, it means that they're not available for something that may be a higher level of emergency. And when a caller calls to ask for 911 to be transported, we do not say, well, let me see whether you really need to go. If they ask to go, then we will take them. But this is very interesting to see, and it would be very interesting to map the lakes first too, because the two crews support each other. So if the Medic 5 is out, our contract crew is out at the hospital, then the lake will cover that. So they will go. The lake crew will go anywhere in the county, and also the Medic crew will go into Lake Monticello. There's not firm lines, but essentially it's based that the first dues are based on population, so that the upper northwest corner area is Lake Monticello's first due and down into like Cunningham area, and then the rest of it is for Fluvanna Rescue. Here's the types of calls that Rescue runs. And I thought it was very interested in Dr. Bond's presentation that one of the goals is to reduce injuries due to unintentional falls. And falls and fractures are our number one call that we receive in the county, which is very interesting. And again, this just shows 85% of the calls that we deal with, because it would get pretty small as it goes down. Fall, fractures, breathing difficulties, and then cardiac, chest pains, or code blues are cardiac arrests. And then motor vehicle accidents are the third number three of what EMS responds to. One of the problems that we talk about are missed calls, or the calls where there's no response. And I did average 80% of the missed calls are first responder calls. So this doesn't mean that the fire company is not responding to structured fires. It doesn't mean that they're, that if somebody is having a heart attack, it doesn't mean that they're not responding, you know, to those when they're called. But there is a higher number of first responder calls versus fire-related calls that are going with no response. If there is a call that comes in and, say, company two is toned and they do not mark up at, within a certain period of time, the second due company would be toned after them. And maybe the second due company will mark up and say, yes, I'm going. Then that is a no response for company, for the first company that was toned. And if they are canceled in route, like if they go on and then are canceled, that's a canceled call, not a no response. So we can be fairly certain just from the hard looking at the data that these are calls that there was no response to the tone. The chart with the bars on the left side of the screen shows that the, remember earlier I showed you the EMS, the fire, and the mutual aid calls. I've added then in the no response calls in there, and it shows you the percentages of what the of how that relates of those calls. So for Lake Fire, for example, they answer 31% of their EMS calls, 53% of their fire calls, 0.4% mutual aid, and 15% of the calls they are not able to answer. Now, we talk about what does the data show and how can we use the data to make decisions for what, you know, what does it tell us and how, what are we gonna do about it? So this data if you listen to the radio, you will hear sometimes first responders are called and there's no response. And when it is a difficulty breathing or an anaphylactic shock, that really gets me nervous because,
okay.
Yes.
I gotta ask one question real quick. Mm-hmm. So you're saying that 56.7% of the calls are not answered? Or?
No. Those are answered. Those are fire calls. Answered.
So just the ones in blue are the ones that are not
answered. Dark blue, right.
Dark blue. Down.
Dark blue in that okay. Chart, yes.
I'm sorry.
When it came out,
I thought you were saying 56.7% were not answered.
That's the four kinds of calls that they're responding to, EMS, fire,
I got that part, but I just wanted to make sure we clarified that the
responses were just the blues.
Bad.
It's not that bad. Not that bad. So what these numbers, what the questions that this numbers at, ask, say to me is, do we have enough first responders available during the day? Because that's when we're seeing, you know, most of the calls are coming in. So do we have enough first responders available? And how do we get new volunteers and how do we do the training? We have not done a first responder class for a number of years. I think it was 2 years ago that we did a first responder class, and we had 12 or 15 of, that went through that. So is it time for another first responder class? The data here would say yes, that may be something. We also may want to revisit what calls are toned out for first responders. For example, all seizures there's a list. It's the calls that it's really important for somebody to get there as soon as possible. But maybe there's some that aren't that if the ambulance is en route. If the first responder call is canceled, remember it goes on the canceled list. But if there's just no response, it's going to be on this no response list. But it may mean that the first responder was not really needed. So is it how we're dispatching them and how does that system all working?
Are the deputies first responders?
No. Now if they're on scene and something's happening, there's been a number of times where played that role. I think many of them are trained in that, but they are not first responders for the fire department.
Okay.
All right, I'm going to change gears here a little bit and give you an update on cost recovery. As you know, billing began November 1st in 2015. And the numbers here that I'm going to give you are the collections for the 9 months are $452,000. The average time from the date of service till we get the cash in the bank is 99 days. Now, we would really like to have, we would like to have that number right under 90 days, and I'll talk about that in a little bit more. The average trip is $404 per trip, and if you look at the little white chart, the average, let's see what this, oops.
No, squeeze underneath the trigger.
Oh, squeeze underneath?
That's the trigger.
Aha! Okay, this part here, the cost per trip, the average is $404. The maximum that we've received is $440 on that. So essentially what we could do is take our $2,600 calls that we do a year, times 70%, times that $404, which should give us a good estimate of that would be the high end of what we could collect. Because there's a variety of calculations that go into what we actually collect on that, with whether what type of insurance it is, whether we get the insurance information, and all those things. We are doing currently an average of 125 trips a month, and we had 450,000 budgeted for FY17, and we have 3 more months left for date of service. But then there's also about 60 days. Of catch-up that we still collect money, but it's only for this fiscal year. It'll only be the calls for the date of service in the fiscal year. So if a call for service is on June 30th, that will be included. The income will be included in this date, in this fiscal year, but we most likely won't collect it for 90 days or 99 if it's the average on that. One thing that is, I always look every month when we get these reports. I look at, well, how can we up our collections, or what are we doing? The process. How can the process be adjusted so that we can get everything that we're not leaving any money on the table, so to speak. And if you look at the payer mix, this chart here, the blue line, at the top is Medicare. This is the Medicare line, and as you notice, it is coming down. This purple line is the billed patient. Now, as this time goes out, this line will come down a little bit more, and hopefully this blue line will go up. What this is telling us is that our providers do not ask you what kind of insurance that you have when you have an ambulance ride in. That's not their primary responsibility, is to treat whatever's happening with you. They're not going to ask you for all that information. And we can get the insurance information at the hospital. But what it does tell me is that our providers may not be getting all of the information that they could, that the demographic information, date of birth, your address, correct spelling of your name, all of that. Because if we don't have that correct in the system, then our billing provider cannot get the correct information from the hospital. And so then it has to go back to the patient, and that it makes that 90 days stretch out. The other thing that you notice here down here on this chart here, where you have the numbers are kind of going down, and then in March there were only 88, and we had in January we only had 38,000 collected, when our average is about 47,000-48,000 a month. The reason these were down is that we, in the fall, we had to change the rescue reports all of their calls to the state through a state bridge. And the state updated their program and made it a whole lot more cumbersome and terrible to handle, version 3. And everybody complains about that. And I will talk about what our solution is, what we're looking at in just a few minutes. But what this represents is Lake Monticello, because the Blue Banner Rescue made their transition last summer. So they had all their issues with V3 last summer. Lake Monticello has had them between December and February. So getting in this the chart that we were talking about here with the payer mix, it also means the consistency of getting calls okayed for billing in the system. And the more consistent that is and that EMSMC can grab the calls and bill them, the more consistent the money comes out at the other end. And there were, because of this change with the bridge, Lake Monticello was behind in that. And so those numbers are representing some catch up there. I think in the long run it'll come out and it'll be okay, but it means that the fluctuations are a little bit greater than we normally see. Also, just a note on cost recovery with the way that we handle volunteers. If you are a volunteer or an employee in law enforcement for the county, you can't be a law enforcement employee for Albemarle and get something in Fluvanna, because while we care about them, it's Fluvanna first. If you are a volunteer or law enforcement employee, all we need for folks to do if they're transported with an ambulance is to fill the top part of the fee waiver form. And there's the last line in there, on that top part says, are you a member, a volunteer or employee? And you check that box, and then we can, that's that's what we use then to write off any balance after insurance. So it's, and I know there's been a number of times when people have gone through and actually paid the bill when they wouldn't have had to. But we have to bill everyone equally. We cannot say, no, well, you don't need to pay. We need to go through a process, because we could get in trouble with Medicare if we single out people and bill people specially. We talked about the bridge, and one of the things that the Fire Rescue Association is requesting, and we need to do a little bit more work on this with state contracts and things, but is to buy our own version of ImageTrend. Right now, we use the state bridge of ImageTrend to report all EMS calls, both to the state, and then EMSMC, our billing agency, grabs the calls from that state bridge. Fire uses another program, Firehouse, to do their reporting. If we got our own version of ImageTrend, both Fire and Rescue could use the same program, and also we wouldn't need separate accounts for each of our agencies. It can be all agency licenses, can be all in one, but you choose which agency you're associated with when you do the reporting. So it's all in one place. It also would mean we would only need one interface with the software in dispatch. So it kind of streamlines some of those processes also. We can also put in mandate fields for the providers to use. One of the biggest things that we get of information returned to the provider from the billing company is that there's no provider signature on the patient report form. It's because it's hidden under a tab. You have to go and look for it specifically in order to sign it. And it's not a required field. And so in the state bridge, I don't know why they didn't think that was something that you should require, but it's not. So when those missing information comes back, we have to send it back out to the provider. And again, that extends that date of service to the time we get the money in the bank. And we do have, 99 days is our average, so we do have a lot of outliers beyond that. If it gets to more than 180 days, Medicare kicks it out. So it's really important that we don't let things stretch out too far. We're anticipating the startup cost of this is going to be around $45,000. Plus, then there would be annual maintenance. We already pay annual maintenance for the firehouse servers, and so there will be a little bit of offset for the maintenance that's being done. But we will come back with a little more clear proposal on this, or if it cannot wait until the next budget season.
Now, for the board, remember on a couple slides before, you saw that so far year to date we've collected $452,000. That's through 9 months. You will clearly collect over $500,000. You only budgeted $450,000 this year. So I would suggest that you kind of pre-commit to using part of those dollars for this ImageTrend software. It's a really important upgrade for fire and rescue, And it's precisely one of the things you said you wanted to use those dollars for, is to support the rescue services in our county. And while you can, you know, wait another year, this is one of the reasons why we're doing the revenue collections through that. And this would, you'd be able to cover it through that at the end of this fiscal year, or anytime you want to do it, because you're going to have greater than what was budgeted revenues from the EMS revenue recovery. So.
And it also might be timing-wise with the new CAD software coming in, and that's something that we will work at as when the timing is the best time to get that in, because of the new interfaces with the new software. I'd rather not do things twice. Let's do it the first time and get it working properly. One of the things that the Fire Rescue Association is working on is a recruitment and retention campaign. Back in January, we were looking at the possibilities of applying for the SAFER grant. The SAFER grant is a firefighting federal grant that either pays for firefighters, but we don't have any. We don't have any paid firefighters, or it pays for recruitment and retention planning. It would hire like a meet for someone to help plan a whole campaign. So what, as we were looking at that grant to see what we could do, we came up with a list of a number of things in the recruitment ideas, training ideas, and retention ideas. And the things in blue are the new things that are possibilities. And again, these are nothing here is set in stone. We are just in the beginnings of pulling together a work group to work on this. And this is something you will definitely see coming. We do have money in my budget for advertising, and so we can get started. On some of the recruitment with dealing with a campaign, doing some advertising or a number of ways of debt. We do have a little bit of money that we can get started on that through my budgeting. The training dollars you gave us the additional money for the net FY18 budget. So we are very thankful for that, and we will use that money very wisely with some of the things that are there beyond what we're already doing. And then we're also working at retention. How do we keep the volunteers we have, and how do we make Fluvanna the best place to volunteer? And whether it includes some of these items. This is a laundry list, not a plan to move forward. Training. The picture on the left is a train the trainer class, and the picture on the right is the firefighter one class doing some ladder work. We currently have I believe it's 12 students in the firefighter one class, and we have been running a firefighter class once a year.
Once a year.
EMT classes are running about twice a year, in August, and then starting another one starting in January. We do continuing ed for the first responders. There's monthly classes that are held and roving in all of the various fire stations for them. I mentioned the train the trainer class. This is so that we can have more instructors that can be in Fluvanna, and we can have availability, but it's a retention tool too, to train people, and then with our classes we pay our instructors too, so it's that helps too. And all of the firefighter classes, one of the things that we have to do is we have to use a burn building. And we use either Albemarle's building or Buckingham's. The top picture is Albemarle's building, the lower building is in Buckingham. When one of the problems that we've seen is that we get bumped, especially with the Albemarle one. They can be scheduled, and a week before the class is scheduled to go and use the building, they get bumped for something else that's happening in Albemarle. The Buckingham facility is actually a very nice facility, but it's an hour away. So if you're taking our instructors, who are some of our prime firefighters, and you're taking them out of the county for all day, that can be a problem. It leaves our county uncovered. So we looked at what the possibilities were to apply for a burn building grant. And I know this is something that has been discussed for in a variety of years. The Virginia Fire Programs does have a burn building grant that's a $450,000 plus $30,000 for E&A materials. And what we would do is apply for the grants. This is the kind of building we would want. They would say yes, and then it would go out to bid, and construction would happen and go that way. So getting the grant does not mean does not commit any county dollars for it. I did talk with Fire Programs, and Fluvanna would qualify for this. It's based on need, and it's also based on the distance to the nearest one, and the fact that we've been getting bumped is a really good in their eyes of that we may need a different facility. We would like to move ahead with filling out the application, and that it is due July 1st, but it would need to come to you back to you for approval beforehand. What we're thinking at this point is the possibilities of putting it behind the Fork Union Fire Station. There's about 100 acres in there, so it would be county property already, and that is also a plus in the fire program site because the county would be involved. Our goal is to not have any of the, for the construction, not to have any costs come back to the county, that it would be all covered by the grant.
And we're already planning cutting timber back in that area anyway, so we'll be able to clear in the area.
Is that timber ready?
We've talked about that.
Yeah, we've got one of the.
We talked about it.
There's pockets of that back there, yes.
We don't have any other plans for the land behind Falcon.
And you wouldn't need all 100 acres.
Either. Oh, no, it'd be a.
So it wouldn't be a.
You're talking about a 40 by 40 building?
Yeah. Probably be a 2 acre or a 3 acre plot, you know, at the most. Wouldn't be very much.
There's water there. There's already, you know, and that's a big thing. We looked at the possibilities of Lake Monticello. We've looked at, you know, there was some discussion of at Tenasca. There was a number of different places, Pleasant Grove. But water, having county land already in a place that's a little more unpopulated, that Lake Monticello, people may complain about all the smoke because that's the whole idea of having a building that looks like it's on fire. So that could be it could be a very good a good place. But again, we would come back with more detail if you're agreeable to
we could pursue.
But they would only do that few times a year, wouldn't they?
We'd probably do it once a month at least.
Yeah.
It would be used on a lot more regular basis than what we should use it now because we have to go other places.
But it wouldn't be used just for ours either. We'd be renting it out to others who want to come in.
Right. I mean, maybe the shops are going to be using it.
If they can get it with a grant, folks, I'm telling you, this would be something that would be well worthwhile. It would, in the long run, save our county money if we can get.
But it's not just a lot of smoke. You're talking about going into the building, doing different kind of rescues, right?
Right. But basically, what they do is they start fires. I mean, there's two types of buildings. There's one that uses gas, and there's one that you take straw and pallets and things, and you start a fire in it. And they're monitored so that it can only get so hot. In it, so there's safety things there. The gas part, you can just turn the whole thing off. But part of it is the heat, getting used to the new firefighters to the heat and to the smoke and using the breathing apparatus and all of that is very important to the training. If we had a facility like this here, I think there would the classes that they would do a lot more training in the facility, whether it's
Well,
And we would still be in the county, so if we got a call, we could back up and go to a call.
And a much more visible sign for potential.
That's the biggest thing for
taking high school students for tours through the firefighting facility and things to get more volunteers.
Or doing high school classes because it's here.
And apparatus.
Changing subjects.
So just to get the sense of the board, can they work on the application and come back to you for review and approval?
Yes.
And the goal really would be, I mean, we're very aware that tails of grants often cost more than the grant, and so we're not going to let that happen.
You've got a yes.
Okay. An update on the radio project. We are waiting for the final approval from the FCC on the frequencies. They have been coordinated and approved that way, so we're 95% through on the frequencies, which means that some of the radio equipment that's specific to the frequencies can be ordered, and I think it'll be ordered this week. The tower sites will be complete in early May. The microwave, one of the microwave dishes. At the storage over where they are. They're about six feet in diameter. Then the system would be turned on and optimized late May. We would do coverage testing in early June, training for the providers and also for the administration of the system in June. And then cutover could happen as early as late June. More likely it's going to be early July. And then a 30 to 60 day burn-in period for the project. And here are,
I'll try.
See if it'll run, if it doesn't.
Nope,
okay. Here's some pictures of the shelters being set, and the big picture is a video of them moving the crane, moving the building at Columbia School. This one and this one are out at BREMO at the power station. And this one is the CBEC tower. As you can see, they stick build them up to a certain height. This is a small crane that can only put it up to 120 feet. And then the big boy comes in and stacks the rest of the tower up.
So there's a man standing up at the tip of that.
Yeah, there's a man here and a man here, because the crane has this is rope, and it has this piece here that's like this and this. Uh-huh. And so they attach it, it gets attached here, 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 and then the next one comes across like this, and it has a stake in here. So it was pretty high up with the way that they were doing that. Was interesting to watch, not something up. And then when they got up here, when they were up here to attach this, to get down to unattach these things, they slid down on their butt down there to get that. That was a little bit nerve-wracking to watch.
Mm-hmm. I'm glad you said.
All right, so along with the radio project, one of the surrounding areas, surrounding communities have been working on a regional collaboration. As you know, LUISA has been planning to join our system all along, and they should sign their contract by the end of May with Motorola, saying that they would join our system and basically share our core. But the other counties here, so Fluvanna and LUISA are already talking that we're moving ahead. And Madison and Greene are also wanting to join the VHF system. Albemarle just had a intent to bid. Well, they're going to stay 800, and they made an announcement to go with Harris System, which is not Motorola. So these four would be Motorola. Orange County has not decided yet what they're going to do, whether they're going to stay VHF and join our system, or whether they're going to go with their neighboring counties to the north and have a new 700 system. And that just is the frequency in which they broadcast from. The whole reason behind doing a regional collaboration is for better interoperability among the jurisdictions and to be able to share resources and share costs wherever we can. So our system was built to host both Fluvanna and Louisa without any upgrades. We have, and so if to move forward, what we would do is we would share our core and we'd split the cost 50-50. It's roughly about $750,000 is what we paid for the core. And then we would share the cost of the annual maintenance of that. It's budgeted for ours as $115,000 a year. We would share the core portion of that, which is probably about $80,000 to $90,000. I don't know exact. So it would cut that annual maintenance cost in perpetuity down in half for us. Each county would be responsible for own towers or own equipment on it, annual maintenance, and also licensing to use the system. Now, what happens then if Madison and Green decide they do want to join or even more? We would need to upgrade our L core to an M core, and the two essentially means that the backup is at the same place. So you have two boxes. If one fails, it goes to the second box. What we would do if we go bigger than just Louisa and Fluvanna, we would upgrade the core because you have to have, L core only can have 14 sites, and we have 13 between the two counties, and an M core can have up to 24 tower sites. So we would have to upgrade. We would also geographically separate the backup functions because it just makes sense if something happens to one geographical location, if you have your backup in another location. It's not a problem with the L core and the way we're moving ahead because there's so much redundancy built into it that we have no concern about the system failing, because if one part of it fails, another part kicks in and allows us still to operate. If the four counties are on, and this is not including Orange and Albemarle because we're assuming they're going to be going to a different system and different vendors. And in order to share a core, you have to be the same vendor on that. But we would share the cost, the original cost of the core, and then also share the maintenance, which would be a quarter each rather than the half that we saw in the previous one. There is an upgrade cost to upgrading from the L2 core to the M2 core here that is about, and then also geographically separating. The two are, with labor figuring, it's about $300,000. And that is within grant range. This is truly a regional project, and we've met already with the RPAC-1, I don't remember what RPAC stands for, but it's the committee that on a state level that looks at communication projects. And they have agreed that this is the definition of a regional project. So it's very likely that we could get that money to do that. But even if we don't, splitting $300,000 four ways is a lot more reasonable than if each county would have their own system. The biggest benefit to this, by sharing the core, it extends our footprint. So if the four counties in red would be on one system, this area would be covered because of the overlap in it. So essentially, I could be up here in Madison County, click on my radio, and talk directly to Fluvanna County. I would not have to change channels or anything. Or same way, a deputy could be in Bremo Bluff and have to take a prisoner to the Orange County Jail. He could drive all the way up to the jail and never have to change his channel on his radio. Now, if his cell phone doesn't work, he's SOL, right, on that. So that's one of the things, the biggest thing is it extends our footprint. And it also allows us to share the initial costs that we put out, and then, more importantly, the ongoing maintenance because of the cost.
Did you say Orange had already made up their mind?
They have not. They have not. And we have a meeting on May 12th with all of the county administrators with actually all of these counties or representation from all of the counties to talk about what can we do. And we will be coming back after that meeting with a more detailed presentation and asking for a high-level MOU for the board to agree to that says, yes, we want to work on a regional basis. And then more detailed MOUs would come, like there'll be need to have one with Louisa and Fluvanna on the current system of how that actually happens. But we are very excited about this possibility because it gives, you know, the people that we work with all the time, it gives us direct access and without having to worry about having interoperable channels in our radios. Last slide. Thank you for your patience. Here's a number of things that we are looking at, that the Fire Rescue Association is working on. We feel like it is time to add a fire chief position, a paid fire chief position to the county roles. And we are planning to put this in the FY19 budget request. Chief Brent says he's ready to finally retire for real. He's been threatening for a while, but I think he is ready to retire, and it would be a good time to hand over some of this work. So we are working on that, and that'll be part of the budget process upcoming.
Fire chief or fire EMS chief?
Okay.
Yeah, it would be the whole thing.
Oh, that makes it a little different.
Yeah. Adoption of the fire code. Right now, Fluvanna has not adopted the fire code. So what that means is that our building official can say, all right, new subdivision, you need, or new business, you need to put in fire lanes, and you need to put up signs for the fire lanes. And as soon as they get their final occupancy, they can take those down, and we can't do anything about it because the fire code is not enacted. So we have no teeth to insist on things like fire lanes, signage, flow rates, where hydrants are placed in subdivisions, and things like that. And we do, adopting the fire code is not an all or nothing. It used to think that if we had a fire code, we'd have to have a fire marshal, and that means, you know, more responsibility. We don't need to do that. We can only adopt only the parts that we want. That actually gives us teeth to do the maintenance and for code enforcement on things. So we will be bringing that to you soon for that. We are also, this summer, we'll probably do an RFP for EMS contract services, not because we're unhappy with UVA and the services that they're giving us, but it's just good practice every 3 to 5 years to check to make sure we're getting the best deal for our money. And so that will be coming forth. We already talked about the burn building grant, and we've talked too about the purchase of Image Trend. We'll be coming back with you on that. And then we are also in the process of working on updating our building and apparatus MOUs. Especially with the deeding of the Palmyra station, we need to be real clear on what's volunteers' responsibilities, what's county responsibilities, and to make them consistent, because some of the fire departments are doing things a little different than others, and so it just makes sense to have that updated. But also with the apparatus, especially with the move, considering the move to put all of the apparatus, whether it's county owned or county co-owned or with Lake Monticello's in, and having an understanding about, no, this is, you know, we're not going to take Kent Store's fire truck and put it into Lake Monticello. I mean, it belongs to the agency that it was intended for. But having that in an MOU just helps keeping things clear. Can I answer any questions for the board, or do you have any questions for my colleagues?
One thing came to my mind when we were talking about the core. If we spend $750,000 with Louisa to buy a core.
No, we already have it.
You already bought it.
I know that.
Yeah.
But if we have to upgrade to an M2, It almost seems to me to be fair if we're upgrading because we're adding two other companies that they go back and pay us 1/4 of that $750,000.
Oh, they would. Yeah.
We just said they were going to pay 1/4 of $300,000.
No. $300,000 was just for the separate location of the second core.
Right.
The M2 core is going to be more expensive.
I wanted to make sure that that was part of it.
They would be sharing costs from the ground floor.
We'll be getting money back, not spending any more, is the goal.
Definitely.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Tab F.
Good evening. I'll try and keep this.
Comparison of code compliance procedures.
I'll try and keep this as short as possible.
Before Mr. Newman starts, this one is really important. You've been asking about it for years. We have a hard time enforcing things that the board members have talked about, citizens have talked about 50 a zillion times. I get calls all the time. So we really need some strong direction from the board on which way to go on trash and debris, inoperable vehicles, and also I'm going to do a little section at the end about buildings and derelict buildings and decrepit buildings, things like that. So there's a lot of meat here. You've got, I think, a package in front of you. Right. You can take it home, review through all the information from the different counties. But this one is really important, and we've got a lot of work to do on it.
And we can email this to you as well. Our code compliance officer and our zoning administrator are here this evening to help answer any questions you may have as a result of this. First talk is about trash ordinances. Applicable state code, section 15.2-901, gives us the authority to provide for the removal or disposal of trash, and that the owners of the property shall remove any and all trash or other substances which might endanger the health or safety of residents, as determined by the governing body. If the board of supervisors make a determination and the applicant or the owner doesn't pick up the trash, we can charge them with tax liens and fines. This is our county's ordinance language. Again, unlawful for any owner of a property to allow any such accumulation of such material as the board of supervisors shall determine might endanger the health of the residents of the county. After the BOS makes its determination, the applicant is given a certain amount of time. I believe we do a customary 30 days. If they don't clean up the property within 30 days, the county can do that, and then the cost is put onto the property and the owner as a tax or levy.
And even on this one, in that first paragraph, it may be useful just to expand the language to say might endanger the health and safety of residents of the county, because the state code says that. Because if you just say health, sometimes there's some arguments about, well, that's not bothering anybody, but, you know, safety and kids playing on things. There's a thousand reasons, ways to look at this. We can't be more strict. I mean, we can't be outside of the state code, but we want to be as clear as possible so it's enforceable.
All our local counties do trash enforcement as part of the county ordinance. We'll talk about the difference between county ordinance later when it comes to inoperable vehicles, but right now it's all done through the county ordinance rather than through a specific part of our zoning ordinance. Summary of all local jurisdictions: Savannah, Albemarle, and Cumberland all require Board of Supervisors action when dealing with trash. Savannah and Albemarle both have a process that takes upwards and usually past 30 days. Cumberland, they give a 5-day written notice from the county to the owner to remove trash. If they don't, the Board of Supervisors can then make a determination after those 5 days are up, and the county can dispose of the trash. In Dinwiddie County, where they don't require Board of Supervisors action, it's just purely administrative. They're given a letter. They have 14 days to respond to the letter and make the corrections as required, and after those 14 days, the county can take over. For Goochland, they have 7 days, and for Louisa County, 30 days. The current issue that we have is that our county ordinance requires that the Board of Supervisors make a determination that the trash ordinance has been violated. This is a time-consuming process. It takes over 30 days. The code officer first has to receive a complaint. He has to go out to the property, document the violation. He has to bring the case before the board. The board has to make a determination. A notice has to be sent. They're given about 30 days. And then if they don't comply after those 30 days, the county can hire contractors to go out and take care of the problem. We recommend that the process be streamlined and made more administrative so that a notice of violation letter be sent out with a set time period for cleaning up trash, like we did in Dinwiddie, where they had 14 days. Failure to comply would then result in the county taking corrective action for subsequent tax liens or fines, and this process would be dealt with by our code compliance officer who reports to our zoning administrator. The board wouldn't have to be involved, less paperwork and activities for y'all to have to look at, and an easier way for the county to take care of a problem that occurs quite often.
But it would be based on the policy, the ordinance that you set, here's the rules, and then we would just be enforcing those rules rather than the process that's a little more cumbersome now.
Yeah. Next section, inoperable vehicles. State code allows us the authority to restrict the keeping of inoperable motor vehicles, and particularly subsection E of that says that the vehicles must be screened, and screening means it shall not be visible by someone standing at ground level from outside of the property on which the subject vehicle is located. Mr. Payne might be able to speak to this, but I think that means you can't just put a tarp over it. It has to have a fence or otherwise be blocked from view.
And we've always, for our local, we've always just said it had to be covered. But, you know, having five junk cars in your yard that are covered with a tarp that blows half off and is half hanging down, it's probably not exactly what we want.
Yeah. Mr. Payne, is that the way you see it?
That's, excuse me, that's probably right. We've done it with opaque screening, and we've done lots of different kinds of opaque screening.
Furthermore, from our zoning ordinance, we only really regulate inoperable vehicles when there's more than five. In this case, they have to be more than five and exposed to the weather, and that's considered an automobile graveyard. Right.
Go back up one, please. So, and then the bottom, there's two sections of code in the zoning ordinance. One is about the automobile graveyard and the salvage yard, but the bottom one talks about no inoperable vehicle should be parked or stored. That is, unless it's in a fully enclosed building structure or otherwise shielded or screened from view of all public roads and adjoining properties. So we have to more clearly define what that is. And again, there's no provision in any of our code to do anything with less than six vehicles. So.
Currently, our county, Cumberland, and Goochland all deal with vehicles through their zoning ordinance and through that definition, for our purposes, through that definition we just went over. Albemarle, Dinwiddie, and Louisa all deal with this as something that can be addressed through the county code. Their zoning ordinance is meant to deal with big ticket items, again, like more than five vehicles. We currently don't have any mechanism for dealing with less than five junk vehicles. It's at that six that we have the cutoff. And furthermore, since it's part of our zoning ordinance, an applicant, if they're given a letter of violation, they're allowed to appeal to our Board of Zoning Appeals, similar for the other counties that have it within their zoning ordinance.
Which ends up just costing more money, because if they appeal to BZA, then we've got to pay the BZA members to meet and the attorney to be there and things like that, too.
And as you can see, most localities give like a 30 days notice. Goochland does 10, Louisa does 15 days notice, and Louisa is the one that has a... It's just under the county ordinance, not to the zoning ordinance. Cumberland doesn't allow any vehicles at all. They have no limit. This is agriculture purposes. No motor vehicles, which aren't inoperable, may be allowed unless they are fully enclosed within a building or structure or otherwise shielded from view. Dinwiddie has the same thing. Goochland has a limit of three. Louisa has a limit of three. It'd be nice if we could have something that was more definitive where we would not allow any vehicles unless they're enclosed or fully screened, and also that we had it so that the process wasn't allowed to have another appeal period to the BZA. So our current County Code Chapter 15, Motor Vehicles and Traffic, does not address inoperable vehicles, and therefore we have no enforcement mechanism for dealing with less than six inoperable vehicles, because six or more constitutes that automobile graveyard. The zoning ordinance therefore only deals with six or more and requires a 30-day appeal period and recourse to the Board of Zoning Appeals. So staff would recommend that we amend Chapter 15 of our County Code to allow for enforcement of screening for less than five junk vehicles. I'm just looking for discussion and direction.
Anyone have anything to add or say?
And you won't be able to solve all this tonight, but we really want the sense for what the board wants to do and where you're going to go with this, and then the county attorney to address advice and guidance on what's legal to be as clear and specific as possible,
right.
So we have the rules to the enforcement authority. Mm-hmm. Does the board... Is the board interested in having more clear
Guys, we can look at anything.
Yeah, I mean, as far as the vehicles go, I think I personally like Louisa's. I don't think we need to be as restrictive as Cumberland's. You know, three vehicles and then screening, something along those lines.
I will tell you that this is going to be a sore subject with a lot of people.
Yep,
sure. And that's why I think starting with something less
the typical
intense
response
as Cumberland probably makes
I'm
sense.
I'm a collector, and this 57 Chevy I got in my front yard is something that I'm restoring. It was my brother's in high school, and I'm restoring it. You know, it's been 13 years that I've worked on it. But and you get that back and forth. So you can expect that you will get calls about both sides of this issue. So just be ready for that.
Right. And then as far as the trash ordinance, if you would, I like the idea of the board not having to do anything.
There is one virtue of having the board do it. There's maybe two. One is that it adds an element of publicity, so that Joe Jones has a big trash pile in his backyard, and the review reports that the board ordered that cleaned up. There's an element of that, you know, sort of public shaming thing. The second thing is that if we take the board out of it, I think we're going to have pretty much more substantial rules to define when things have to be picked up, so that, you know, the county administrator or whoever would make the decision, and you'd have to have some standards, because, you know, clearly if I burn wood for my heat, I may go out and gather up scrap wood to burn and have, you know, old pallets or whatever it might be. It may look like trash to you, it may look like furnace to me. So we're going to have standards for doing that. Now, obviously, you got to, let's say you got a compost pile, and occasionally everybody's going to put a piece of paper in his compost pile by accident or whatever. That's another example. Third example is I collect aluminum cans to recycle, and people get paid for that. And I have a big pile of aluminum cans because I take them to the recycler, you know, once a month. Is that going to be included? And I'm suggesting that I don't think anybody here thinks it should be. But what if I take them once a year? So I think I'm not saying you can't do it that way. I'm not saying you shouldn't do it that way. But you are going to introduce an element of standards for the administrator to use. I think when the board does it, the board is making a determination in each case. So that's easy for me. So we would need guidance on that if you want to do that.
I think getting feedback from some of the surrounding counties, again, Louisa, their particular program sounds similar to what I would prefer. But just getting feedback as to when they made these changes, what the implementation is, when they're doing the enforcement, how are people reacting, you know, how often is this coming up as a hot spot? They're all relatively similar counties in many respects, so I think we could expect that the response from their plan, from their zoning code enforcement folks or the county administrators would give us a good idea of what we might expect.
That help, Mr.
Thank you.
Yes, sir. We're not close to done. So get some information from the other counties on how they've been enforcing theirs and what problems they face.
Sure. To Mr. Payne's point, if there's a lot of consternation, if you would, over what it defines a heap of trash or not, at least we'll have some sense in terms of, you know, again, the case of Louise, 30 days and after the notice is given, seems to me an easier way to do it than to sort of pass something that's more restrictive that requires more action from the board. But I personally think the board can trust the county to do the right job when it comes to enforcing these kinds of things.
Of course you can if you give us the right rules.
Right.
I mean, that's kind of the point, is there needs to be very clear rules on what you say is a problem. And I don't have any problem at all with the board having action on it, as long as the process is as reasonably streamlined and clear-cut as it can be, because everybody in our county ought to have a fairly clear idea of whether their neighbor's house is a trash pile or not, mm-hmm. or who to call if they think it is. And I'm not suggesting that you need to ramp it way down or open it way up. I'm just suggesting let's make it more clear than we have and have a very clear process that's easier to do than what we've got. If the board wants to stay with what we've got, then we will. But the number of complaints has been going up and up and up. I get more and more calls all the time. I got another 3 units the other day, and I actually reported 2 myself last week. So,
we need to spend some time educating the community too, sure. about it, and so that questions can come forward and we can address those.
Yeah.
One other thing that Section 901 brings up is what some people call noxious weeds. Your neighbor doesn't cut his grass for 2 or 3 months, just because he likes to see it grow or whatever.
Suppose they lose their job. The lawnmower doesn't work.
Well, it might be
crazy.
Might just like
that's what may happen, but maybe somebody just sits there and says, "I just want to fuss about this guy's not cutting his grass."
Yeah,
he might do that, and that's one thing that you're going to need. You're going to need to think about that too, because some people will think that's a really good idea. Some people will think it's not. But Mrs. Eager's farm, the fields look better than my yard, but a lot of people's yards look worse than the average farmer's fields. And it makes a difference in a rural, obviously if you're in a city, that's a very easy thing to do. The guy's got grass that's ankle high, that's a problem in a city. It's not necessarily a problem in a rural area, or not as much of a problem anymore. Mm-hmm. So, but I'm just saying that you need to think about that.
How would you handle hay fields that are going to be hayed?
Oh, I think a hay field.
Oh, no.
We'd have to be extremely clear that we're not talking about agriculture.
We're really talking about residential lots.
Yeah, okay.
And to some degree, if somebody's got, 100 tires and 25 trash bags out in the middle of the field, we might be looking at that.
No, that's
we're
different.
Really talking about residential lots.
No, I'm talking about you don't want to go tell Mr. Sheridan that his favorite rabbit covert has now been ordered to be cut over.
Mm-hmm. Not be a happy person.
So from a trash perspective, go ahead, Jesse.
I just wanted to add, I was at Dinwiddie County when we adopted this ordinance back in 2011, and it was primarily a reaction to the county over the previous 20 years approved a lot of small lot agriculturally zoned subdivisions, and that brought a lot more intensity of problems in rural areas than previously existed. So previously there wasn't really much of an enforcement mechanism, and it seemed to work very well given a set timeline. 14 days seems a reasonable timeline with civil penalties and just this really ramping up enforcement on that, just because we were getting a lot of complaints. They were calling the county, people were moving in as the subdivisions were developing, and we were getting a ton of complaints. And we're having a similar situation here. We're getting a ton of complaints, but we just don't have the, mm-hmm. quite the mechanism to take care of it in a timely, speedy fashion.
Right. Thank you.
So that's, again, you can review the package that we gave you, look at it in more detail, and we'd like feedback. And then this is the summary on the inoperative vehicles. I think the Louisa one sounds pretty reasonable, too, but do you want to be us to looking at setting limits something less than 6? Because right now we have no enforcement authority below 6, and we had lots of calls around about this one as well.
So. Yeah, I have one junk vehicle or 2 junk vehicles. There's effectively nothing that Scott Miller, our co-compliance officer, can do about it. We just don't have the language to deal with a situation like that.
Even you'll see some where there's 2 of them sitting in the front yard right next to the highway, but we don't have a lot of enforcement authority.
Right now, we have a case before the Board of Zoning Appeals involving upwards of 25 inoperable vehicles that have been moved in.
That's his position. He's a collector.
So it's a much slower process.
They can build a building to make sure they are.
Build a building. Put a half fence.
There you go.
We've had all kinds of comments like that from this guy, so, but it does happen. One thing about it that I don't know whether you all know this, but there are programs to take old vehicles.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And they'll actually pay for them or at least take them away.
Right. Right.
So it doesn't cost you anything to get rid of them.
I'll be glad to give them the NPR number anytime they want it. So.
So
like the trailer, the mobile home thing that's in Columbia sitting all on the highway that's been there forever. Mm-hmm. I finally found out who owns it now. But. And a bunch of that stuff has been moved. The picture that I showed you 2-3 weeks ago has been moved now. So
we're making progress.
Yeah. So we'll do the same thing on both inoperable vehicles and with the trash. We'll check with our county colleagues to find out what they've had in the way of problems, number of complaints, public comments, enforcement issues, et cetera.
Well, what their rules are, too.
Well, we know what their rules are.
Okay.
I mean, that's what this is. This is their rules, right. So we'll follow up and find out how they've been handling and how it's been working out. We'll coordinate with the county attorney's office, try to come up with maybe a little bit different structured language and give you a couple different alternatives on enforcement options to try to keep it as reasonable for our citizens as possible and as reasonably quick as possible to actually enforce something. Mm-hmm. So.
Okay, let's go ahead and get to the next one. Said you got
and then the next
more.
One, let's see. So just a really quick blush on this one, because I think we've got some similar questions on buildings and structures, especially with the recent discussion on Columbia with some of the facilities that are there. That federal grant will take care of four of the facilities, but any place in our county where we have a potential hazardous structure, the Virginia Residential Code and the Virginia Property Maintenance Code that's used by our Building Inspections Department has some fairly substantive issues in it, but I'm not sure that it's all potentially applicable to everything we do. So we've got that, and then there are all these different code sections in the state code that talk about derelict or decrepit buildings or buildings that are used harboring illegal drug use or et cetera, et cetera. And I'm not sure exactly how to wrap that all together, but we want to work with Fred's office to try to figure out if our existing ordinances give us all the clear guidelines, or if the state code already does and we don't need it, or whatever.
Well, I think you've heard me say I have some considerable experience with this idea. And it depends on how far you want to go. I would probably be somewhat reluctant to go to the 907 thing where it's talking about harboring illegal drug use. I think that smacks more of old parts of Hopewell or something like that, or Petersburg. I'm not saying we don't have drug use, but I think that's not the kind of problem we have. The kind of problem we have, frankly, is what we've got in Columbia. And as I've told you before, many years ago, I actually wrote an ordinance for the town of Columbia to implement. It wasn't this section, but it was one of these. It was the predecessor of one of these sections. So if you had a fallen down building and it was determined to be derelict, the locality, in that case the town, could order you to secure it or to remove it. And securing it might mean boarding it up or whatever it might be. But if you didn't, then you were given a time. If you didn't, then the town could do it, in our case the county, could do it and bill the owner for the cost of getting it done. And we could sue the owner for that cost, but in addition, we would record it as a tax lien on the property. And we had experience doing that with, I don't remember how many buildings, but it was more than one in the town of Columbia, and it worked pretty well. It got things done relatively quickly. Now, there again, you're going to have to use some discretion on this, because somebody that's got, you know, an old hay barn down in some field that didn't bother anybody is one thing, but you've got a house with the roof caving in and things like that that's, you know, 100 feet from the road could be an attraction for children and snakes and all kinds of things, and they're different issues. So it's not unlike the trash and noxious weeds ordinance. It's just in the architectural setting, if you will. But it is a practical remedy.
So, any...
So 906, I mean, seems pretty reasonable.
Pardon?
Like the 906.
906 is the basic statute.
Yeah, I don't think we have too many 908s around.
No, probably not, but that's, I would think, a little more city-based and things like that. So.
Well, we could have one specifically.
I could start tagging stuff if you want me to.
We could do a 908.1 to identify all the bawdy places, and we'd have to make sure Mr. Weaver didn't get a hold of that list.
Never can tell. Yeah.
So I haven't had time to go through what our code says and how strong it is, but I think if we're going to look at these types of things, it'd be nice to kind of do this as kind of one consolidated fell swoop, where you look at trash and litter and inoperable vehicles and buildings and structures, and maybe update those all kind of at one time, so it's a discussion, a community discussion at one time.
Sure.
So if you're going to get outcry, you're going to get outcry at one time, but we can kind of talk about them all. And there may not be a need to update code on this section, but I'd like to take a hard look at all three of them. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
I know I've gotten complaints from okay. almost all of you about properties for us to investigate and look at. Courthouse?
Well, no, I'll be a yeah.
Yeah.
But I've heard three yeses. So.
Okay. Good. So we'll go forward with that. And I'd like to thank James Newman. James really did a lot of work in pulling this all together and finding a lot of language. And then, of course, the staff and Jason Stewart's staff and planning and Scott Miller have worked hard to try to consolidate this and bring to you a story that can help us get to an easier
when
place.
We understand, we've been part of it.
All of us would like to see this move forward. I mean, I think we all have had some concerns.
That,
we're not voting.
Is that kind of unanimous that everybody's agreed to?
We got one more. Presentation.
Thank you.
G. Pleasant Grove Road update. That's the only presentation.
Well,
for now.
Just talking about the
business. And then the new business.
I hope to actually keep this brief.
This is actually good news for.
Well, a while ago, some carryover money was allocated, I think $98,000, to potentially do some paving on. Sorry.
Use the blue shoulder for both screens. You have to use the trigger, I mean.
But.
The blue section here of what I think is called. This is.
Just going down by the ball
competition
field.
Competition Park Drive is the name of it. Here and as we looked into what was necessary to pave this road and make it so that it could potentially be accepted by VDOT, it became evident that VDOT still has a recreational access program fund available, and we were told it's not being utilized as widely as some areas. And Steve, how do I get to the next?
Just the right silver button. There is no net. You want
that?
Well,
in there?
Then you've got to ask for it.
Well, I think y'all have copies of of a spreadsheet that shows we have the potential to leverage the $98,000 that you budgeted into a maximum of $506,000. Now, I sincerely doubt that we would ever get $506,000 for the roads of Pleasant Grove, but it wouldn't surprise me if we got $300 out of it. We're still working with VDOT on some of the issues surrounding the first round of recreational access funding, which, now I do need to go back to the pictures. Where did you find it? Anyway, the initial scope of the initial work would have taken that road all the way out to the end of where the blue line is. In my, some of my initial conversations with VDOT, they were asking me why it didn't get built in its entirety with the first round, and not having been here in 2009-10 when it was built, I didn't know, so I began researching it. And from Marty, it appears that VDOT was aware at the time, though, that the scope got cut down. Apparently, the road was originally intended to run somewhere up. I'm only getting a little X now. Anyway, it's up here. And when they built the soccer fields, they moved the road down here.
Just use the other one and have everybody watch the big screen for a minute.
I don't know what the heck's going on with it.
I'm all over.
And apparently building the road down here was more expensive. Actually, the first road started way out at 53, the Endless Road, and then it went. So they ended up ending it right here with that little temporary cul-de-sac that everyone knows who's ever driven out there. And then just kind of building the rest of it, or improving the rest of an existing gravel road on the way down. I'm going to be talking with VDOT in the ensuing days. Marty found some minutes from a meeting that pretty well explains what happened here as far as the scope getting cut back. And I think that if the board were to ask for some funding, we would probably be able to leverage some. I just kind of wanted to know if you're interested in doing that. Looking at this, you have the potential to get, especially if we're considering a bikeway, up to $310,000 in monies that don't require any kind of matching fund. So we may not have to spend our own $98,000. But in addition to that, if we were to use $98,000 of our own money, we could potentially get another $98,000 from VDOT for a total of $506,000, which should more than cover the three roads that I showed you on that sketch.
The blue road, is it going to stop where that shows, or is it going to go all the way down?
It's going to stop where that shows right now, because we haven't constructed the other two ball fields. And
the two baseball fields are back there.
When we construct the other two ball fields back
there,
we're not going to want a road with vehicles driving through the middle of them. We're going to make it into a pedestrian complex. So
it would come around behind.
Because what I want to do is route this road around the back of the outfield of the existing ball fields. About the only thing you need to access using that road from that point on is whatever kind of parking lot you might build there, but also the public works sheds and stuff that are back further east.
Having the parking between those four sets of fields is dangerous right now, because they park right up close to the fields as it is, and so we'd have parking adjacent to it.
Paved parking or still grass parking?
It would either be grass or gravel, but like we've got, because we've got gravel and grass parking lots out there now. don't push any more buttons. It might
all kinds of stuff going on here.
Your fuzzy red dot.
Apparently, with the first construction, we were supposed to build a 200 vehicle parking lot somewhere in this area.
Is that a UFO?
Which never got built, and so I don't know if VDOT's going to have anything to say about that when we go to get more funding. But what I'd like to do is just advise you, and I'm explaining why we haven't already moved forward on paving the road. I think it's worth continuing to put it off. If necessary, I think I can find somebody that can spray some calcium chloride or something on the gravel this summer to try to keep the dust down without spending a lot of money. And the days of just being able to dump your waste oil are gone.
The other two roads would be paved as well, too?
The plan would be, if we can leverage this for enough money, I would starting with the road that leads, part two would be the Pleasant Grove House Road, which would be an historical site access road. It falls under the same umbrella as the recreational access funds, but then part three would be to pave down just a little bit past where the restroom is. Behind the Pleasant Grove, almost up.
The red one would go to the parking lot, because they won't go beyond parking lots or into parking lots. But right now, that's just a gravel road down through this wet area here, to the garden and the parking lot, because the parking lot's
right here. It wouldn't go to the pole barn.
Well, the pole barn would be the center one, the middle one. And that doesn't go quite all the way back to the pole barn. Kind of taking it up to just past the Pleasant Grove House, at least for now.
You want some dirt roads, gravel roads, to maintain the sort of natural feel.
The barn's going to be right there in the next field, just past the end of the road.
You don't drive to the community.
You're driving to a farm, right?
Museum.
It's got to be, you can go outside of that.
But anyway, we can either go forward right now with getting whatever $98,000 we'll pave on that road, or we can continue with this potential grant process that may take the $98,000 out of play, or...
Let's spend the $98,000 now.
Continue working on the grant process.
We're trying to make...
I'll answer that one for you. Thank you, Mr. Stevens.
I have a problem with $98,000.
All right. We will now end our presentations for
we can
now.
Put a basketball court there with the
next. Next up, folks, I got to get up at 5 o'clock. Next up is the consent agenda. H, accounts payable report, February 2017. I, accounts payable report, March 2017. J, Fluvanna-Charlottesville Judges Secretarial Services Agreement, Mr. Dahl. K, FY17, third quarter voluntary contributions, Mr. Burkhart. L, FY17 Library E-Rate Fund Supplemental Appropriation, Mr. Brookhart. M, FY17 Sheriff's Office Insurance Claim, 2012 Dodge Charger, VIN 2945, Mr. Brookhart. MC, FY17 Sheriff's Office Insurance Claim, 2012 Dodge Charger, VIN 2946, Mr. Brookhart. And N, FY17 Sheriff's Office Insurance Claim, 2014 Dodge Charger, VIN 9289. Are there any items that need to be pulled from the consent agenda?
Well, let's start.
Mr. Dahl.
I'm looking.
I've got faith in you, Mr. Weaver. I absolutely do.
You know I wouldn't skip anything.
That's why I love you so much.
February report or the March report, sir?
What?
February or March, sir?
February. Okay. On 589.
Okay.
What?
69 cents.
589 Rafferty Electric landfill. I'm just sort of curious about that expense. What work do we do down there on that?
You know the landfill he's going to check on.
Absolutely. I keep an eye on that.
Well, repairs to the main power service and installation of another output light near the crash
pad. Okay, cost about $7,000.
Tower? Recycling bins that are to the left.
We'll pull the bill and send you the information. Send it to the rest of the board.
Let's try 834. Plumbing for contract plumbing for commercial kitchen. What was that?
The commercial kitchen.
We'll see.
10,000. That's what it is. That was the building the commercial kitchen at the community center. That was the plumbing work to get it set up to build with the commercial kitchen.
So we spent $23,000 on the kitchen plus $10,000 for the plumbing. Is that what we're saying?
I'm not sure what you mean, sir.
Well, it says plumbing for commercial kitchen. We donated $23,000 earlier.
For equipment.
For the equipment? Is this the plumbing for the equipment?
No. It's plumbing for the kitchen, the whole kitchen.
It says commercial kitchen. Plumbing for commercial kitchen.
Right.
We gave $23,000 donated.
I think you gave more than that.
Well, but the last one was $23,000.
And the health department gave $24,000 from their carryover. Mm-hmm. That you approved carryover from the health department to the commercial kitchen. The year before, the board had approved money for the commercial kitchen.
But we didn't approve the whole amount they wanted.
Correct.
Because we had that debate.
Correct. They've gone out and tried to fundraise from other sources and things like that for it. But this was to the building renovation that was ongoing and the rehab of that space to make it into a commercial kitchen. What they came to ask you about was money for the equipment.
For the equipment. That's the point I'm making, though, is that it cost us $10,000 to put that equipment in and all. the plumbing and all. It says plumbing.
Yes, sir.
For a commercial kitchen. So actually it was a 32,000 job.
More than that, because it was electrical work.
Yeah, I know, but the last instance, it was approved for $23,000 7 months back.
$24,000. Okay.
That was in that one wish list. Remember the wish list that we had? And that included the road also in the wish list.
There were two separate lists. That one was the carryover list. That was for end of year funds that the sheriff's office asked to carry over. This department asked to carry over for a specific purpose. The health department asked to carry forward $24,000 to contribute towards the completion of the commercial kitchen. The commercial kitchen design and work and walls and new ceilings and air conditioning, all that stuff, and all the work that's been happening in that building was long approved before that to renovate the building.
Uh-huh.
What the county contributed to was specifically the year before, it was
equipment. The equipment.
Right.
But the point I'm making again is that it cost us $10,000 to then do the plumbing and all for that equipment.
Yes.
So actually it was a 32,000 job. Rather, the point I'm making is it's a tag on it. You know,
The tails.
It's a tail of it. Indeed. You know, we don't ever talk about the tail a lot of times. It's always, here it is, and this is adding to this and to this.
I'm pretty sure you hear me talk about tails and stuff all the
yes,
time.
Yes, I hear you. I've heard you in the past.
It never ends with tails.
It never ends.
Right.
So there was a $10,000 that we never talked about.
I understand.
Okay. That's my point.
Do you have any idea how much the kitchen will be before it's completed?
No, ma'am.
Do you know how much we've spent so far?
No, ma'am. I mean, we pull the records and check and see. I mean, I just signed off on a $29,000 bill today for equipment, kitchen equipment. But that was, again, from all the different sources and the money that came in. We were just, it was a consolidated bill. But we'll have to check and see what the, you know, electrical work was, plumbing work, and then the HVAC and, you know,
construction.
A lot of the work we did internal ourselves. We did the drywall work and the changing walls and moving walls. We did that in house.
We got contractors that do electric work, plumbing work, and
HVAC.
County staff, a lot of county staff did a lot of the, as Mr. Nichols said, a lot of the drywall and demolition of the
old. Yeah. And don't forget, some of the promises were that they were going to do all this cooking and everything, and they're going to eventually at least get back a big amount of that money. So
yes, sir. We'll track it. We will continue to make sure that as Parks and Rec reports, we'll give you a report on how much the commercial kitchen's been used, what's been charged, how many customers, and things like that.
I seem to recall the cost of the kitchen was like going to be like $54,000, $55,000, the initial presentation.
Yeah,
something like that. Well, that's what I seen.
3 years ago, I think he asked for $35,000 total.
Yeah, I think that's
and then it's changed since then because they got some free equipment from a couple of places. Then this item they originally asked wouldn't work, and so they needed a different one. So the price tag has changed since then, but the county's original contribution hasn't gone up, and the health department one was one that was separately approved that the health department recommended using the remainder dollars contribute to finishing off a commercial kitchen.
So that $10,000 could be the $24,000.
It could be funded out of that. I don't know what has been paid for what part yet. But. Mm-hmm.
It wasn't discussed at the time.
$35,000 I think was just for equipment. It was not right. For the plumbing.
$35,000 we gave $24,000 and they had to raise the rest. Or they were buying less expensive equipment, and then if you take the money that the health department gave, $24,000, you're going to end up in that $55,000, $60,000.
The basic thing is the renovation was already ongoing long before you approved any commercial kitchen equipment, because we moved the cooperative extension from this building here to the community center because we thought it was a better utilization of space. We had to rehab the space to put them in, the new Parks and Rec space, and the kitchen space, because the cooperative extension has always had a kitchen facility to use for training classes and things like that. The expanded kitchen, making it a commercial kitchen so it could be rented out and things, was what they were asking for dollars. We were always going to spend money to renovate that space to make it into a kitchen teaching facility like there was right next to my office. You used to be able to walk into my office and you'd smell bacon in the morning and you wouldn't get any of it because they were using it for training classes. But yes, there's definitely some cost to this, Mr. Weaver, but the basic construction maintenance costs was a core sunk cost of that building renovation that we'd done on the front side. The big dollars are for the equipment.
And if you look at the health department grant and you look at what they just presented to us, you know, on their four initiatives, four goals, two of the strategies directly, you know, would apply to the use of the kitchen. You know, strategy two, including cooking classes or demonstrations at Tuesday's table or similar events. And strategy four, identify evidence-based programming that addresses healthy eating, heart health, and faith-based
settings. There's never any end to it. You know, no, it just goes on, snowballs and goes on and on.
I think you'll be pleased.
When
it does come, I think you'll be pleased that the county has helped to create.
I'm sure I'll be pleased with it.
I think you're going to have, I mean, it's places like that that give opportunities to businesses like Red Rocker to start. Yeah, I mean, they do. If you want to create agriculture and sell products, you need commercial kitchens, and we have good opportunity with that.
Well, it'll be a booming place here in Pleland County.
Well, let's hope so.
Okay, we want to look at some other things?
Yes, sir, no problem. And we did have to buy fuel for the fire trucks last week.
Did you? So. Uh-oh. Wow.
I burned some of it.
Did you?
Yes, sir.
Well, have to take it out of our emergency fund. How's that? Okay, 858, 859, and 860.
Okay.
Well, I know we've made some donation to the Farm Heritage Survey and all. Where do we stand on that?
The Farm Heritage Museum RFP on the streets.
No, we just had the pre-bid meeting today.
Oh, pre-bid.
Yeah, well, yes. The
proposals are due back, I think, May 12th for the design of that facility.
We'll be back one week, May 19th.
Okay, May 19th, my daughter's birthday.
Oh, okay.
So this is part of the design specs for the contract to go out.
That was for the original survey work and the site plan.
And May 19th, those young people back here will no longer be students.
That's Malcolm X's birthday, May 19th.
Who's
Malcolm X and Bert Armstrong's birthday.
Oh, I'll have to talk to Bertha at this.
How kind of things come out?
Last day of school. Not that I have that memorized.
This year it is? 19th? Wow.
Trust me, because it's the first day of the playoffs. Oh. Last day of school, we got to start playoffs that night.
And graduation is a training.
While Mr. Weaver's looking, I saw one thing. I think I saw it right. It was a check for 69 cents.
Did we mail that?
Those were our bonuses.
There were checks for $3 and 15 cents.
I'm sorry, I couldn't resist that.
But I saw one 69 cents. I couldn't believe it. I meant to remember the number.
We get checks in for 69 cents sometimes,
too. Yeah. You don't have to find it, but I just thought it was fine.
I'm sorry.
I do look at the bills, too, Mr. Weaver.
Do you? Mm-hmm. Very good.
Where are you going, Mr. Weaver?
Go ahead. You sure? Yeah.
You sure? I mean, please don't think I'm rushing.
You want March 1, sir?
No, I'm okay.
Okay.
You sure?
Yeah, I'm sure.
You good, man?
I'm positive.
I'm sorry.
Are you sure?
I've gotten goofy now. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
All right.
It's not that late, is it?
Too late.
It's only 10.
Yes,
we're just getting started.
We're getting warmed up. All right. All right. Are there any more comments? There are none. Do we have a motion to accept
the consent agenda? I move that we accept the consent agenda.
Do we have a second?
Second.
Motion made by Ms. Booker, seconded by Mr. Weaver. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Chair votes aye. Motion passes 5-0. I do not see any unfinished business.
Chairman,
but
I have
new business.
A little piece of unfinished business, and this is good news.
Thank you, Lord.
On the Needham Village property, We have had a positive response on the road bond and should be receiving the money anytime.
That's awesome.
It's supposed to be on its way.
And on the Country Creek Way one?
Well, we're not quite finished with the Indian Village. There's a $42,000 erosion bond that we've also made demand on. We are told that that one is in process and we should receive it soon, but that's less positive than the road bond.
And the Country Creek Way, we've received that one as well.
So they can start?
No, they've already started, sir. I confirmed to Mr. Ott that it's actually in hand now. So we've got the, based on your agreement, we've got the $80,000 in E&S bond that'll cover the largely the culvert and some other E&S work related things. And then we've already got the $16,000 in hand bond for road work. And so Mr. Ott is aware of that, and they're continuing with their effort. Once that's done, once VDOT says, yes, we're accepting it into our VDOT system, the two things you need to be reminded of is then we can start reimbursing for bills for authorized expenses under those two bonds. And VDOT will require some type of road bond for the first year while it's in service. The county agreed to put that up for the Taylor Ridge subdivision. I'll certainly be bringing the same kind of recommendation to you for that. We haven't had any problems off the Taylor Ridge one, but somebody has to put that up. So rather than the individuals putting it up out of their pocket, last time you approved it for Taylor Ridge, so I'll come forward with the same proposal to you for you to consider.
That bond is to guarantee VDOT as to the maintenance of it.
Right.
So this is not the precarious position that we were in the other one, is it?
What I'm talking about now is the exact same stage we ended up in Taylor Ridge. At the end of Taylor Ridge.
But we had some money on this one, what we're talking about.
Yes. The other one, there was no money, and the residents paid for it themselves.
That's right.
But because they paid for it and went and did all the work and got it in the system, then there was another, they had to do the road bond, and so the county paid for two things. Reimbursement of a fee that was required by VDOT originally, it was about $6,000 or $7,000.
Yeah.
And then the county put up the road bond, so the road was guaranteed for that first year.
But this one actually should not be used in any county money, even though we had to put up, say, $100,000.
Yeah, we won't have to be anything for this one, I don't think, except for the road bond.
Let me emphasize, that's different. A road bond is technically, when we talk about a road bond, we talk about construction. This is a maintenance bond.
I'm sorry, yes.
That
sorry.
Runs in favor of VDOT. So if the road is damaged during the first year or it fails,
they draw against that.
Then they would draw against it. For ordinary maintenance, they would not.
So that means the school buses can go into those roads now.
Once it's taken into the system, yes. Yeah,
right.
Once they accept it. And we're really talking about within the next 90 days, mm-hmm. this should be largely done.
Right. And is it our responsibility to let the school system know?
No, VDOT does that. VDOT? There's a direct coordination between anytime VDOT brings roads in, they coordinate directly with the school system. Mm-hmm. We checked on that with other ones.
Okay, so that takes care of the unfinished business. Now we'll go to new business, Sands Crossroads Water and Sewer Financing Comparison, Mr. Dahl.
So maybe we just talk to you a little bit about some of the county's options of the Sands Crossroads Water and Sewer Project. So regarding financing options, obviously the two funding options are the county can 100% of the project with debt, or what we've been kind of talking about kind of all along budget season is, doing partial debt for the project and partial cash for the project. And if the board remembers, we've kind of talked about that we've kind of just earmarked in fund balance $4 million of cash to use for the Crossroads project. And we're just, right now, like I said, we don't have final costs in here, but we're just saying tentatively $10 million for the overall project price, but we're waiting for final design to come back here, and Wayne, that should be back within the next couple of weeks, probably.
And that's what we'll brief you on your May 17th work session. We'll go through that.
So regarding funding options, those are really the two ways that we can go realistically. We can go fund the Valiant Crossroads project. As far as timing considerations, depending upon what we want to depending on what funding source we want to go with. If we want to go within the summer pool, the VRA has a summer pool, and they have an application deadline by May 1st. So that's kind of one of the reasons that we're here to talk to you this evening. Otherwise, they have a fall pool for 2017, and then they have a spring pool for 2018. The spring pool, if we, you know, say we start construction mid-summer, the spring pool may be a little late to the funds that are needed for moving forward with that project.
Could rates be up on that?
Sure.
Yeah, the rates could definitely be up too.
That's what would concern.
If you have $4 million today, you could pre-fund, you know, the project with $4 million in cash. The problem is, if you're halfway through the project, you may have needed more than $4 million in bills from the contractors by then. And oh, by the way, the later you wait to take up the debt, the higher the interest rate's going to be.
Or you could fund it up front with maybe the debt, hold the cash out, and then if we know that the rates are going to be lower right now, it might be better to lock in rates sooner than later.
Yeah, the only risk of holding the cash back is doing something else with it, but that's a board commitment, and the cost of debt is not going to get cheaper in the next year.
No,
we don't think.
It's not. It's going to go up.
Some of these scenarios for the pool, when we're talking about the pool, this is definitely geared more towards the Virginia Resource Authority. Now, that's not our only financing sources. And on the next slide, it'll kind of show you a comparison that our financial advisor gave us for the two best alternatives as far as rates are concerned. So the first one that we have there is the Virginia Resource Authority. The estimated rate of this would be 3.11%. The benefits are we get the VRA's AAA, AA ratings, and there's slightly lower costs than some of the alternatives below. We could also do the EDA of Fluvanna County. We could do a lease revenue bond with that. Tentatively, the rate's going to be around 3.18%. One of the issues with that, there's higher cost of issuance just due to, you have to go up to rating agencies, and there's obviously a lot more staff time involved as well with going up to rating agencies. Another option is the USDA Rural Development. They gave us an estimated rate of 3.375 to do that. One of the downfalls to their program is that you have to go out and get interim financing first, construct the project, and then they'll do your final financing after it's all said and done. So it's like we're almost having to do two financial transactions to get the project completed. Another option is a bank loan. We go out and solicit bank loans. Typically for bank loans, though, the maximum term that they'll do is a 15-year fix. For this project, we would want to do about a 20-year, 20 to 25-year, but what we base it on is basically a 20-year. So if we did a typical bank loan, it would have to be fixed for 15 years, and then they'd have some type of rate reset period after that. So it would be more advantageous to have a rate locked in for that 20-year period than have to worry about a rate reset later on down the road.
So you have less payments per year for the 20 years.
Yeah. I have a question about that.
Sure.
What's the authority for a bank loan under these circumstances?
What do you mean, what's the authority?
That's long-term financing.
Does that require general obligation?
It is general obligation.
For the bank loan?
If it's 15 years.
That's...
I think if it's being used for...
Just assume that we don't want to do the bottom two.
Yeah. Right.
I'm thinking that the number one is your one-year pre...
Yeah. Understand that with VRA, EDA, and probably with USDA, that's an exception to the debt clause in the Constitution. The general obligation is the requirement of the Constitution.
The very bottom one, we would need a referendum.
That's right.
Except when it comes to running a public utility, then you can do a lease revenue bond, I guess. I don't know.
Lease revenue bond is different. That's not a general obligation.
You can do certain other things.
Right.
But one thing you can't do is you can't do and have the county pledge its credit for more than the current fiscal year. Except one of these exceptions. like BRA. So maybe we're talking about terms that would fall within one of the exceptions, but I don't think of it all. It wouldn't be like the bank loan that you would go to the bank and get.
Gotcha. Scratch that.
That's unconstitutional for a county to do. So it might be available, but it would need some very particular terms.
So scratch the bottom three.
Well, I mean, at the end of the day, so the financial advisor gave us comparisons on the top two. Given the Virginia Resource Authority and the EDA lease revenue funds. So I'm sorry, this is a little small. Mr. Nichols has a page of this here.
This is good.
So if you look off to the right, we've got two big yellow boxes. That's just showing the cost for a $6 million project. And then let's just say that the board decides they want to fund $10 million. The entire project, say the whole project is $10 million. So the first column is if the county were to do a lease revenue bond through the EDA. Box green column is doing the Virginia Resource Authority summer pool. So if we go down each one of these here, so as I noted on the previous slide, the true interest costs for the EDA would be 3.19. It's actually rounded up to that. And then the Virginia Resource Authority would be 3.11%. You can see here the debt service between the two is pretty comparable, 4.23% to 423,000 to 421,000, and the total debt service is about, well, going the EDA route is about $40,000 higher. And, you know, so there's the typical 10-year call provisions on this. So these were really the two alternatives that the county's financial advisor put forward as probably the most advantageous for the county. The one thing with the Virginia Resource Authority, so if we wanted to go with the Virginia Resource Authority, the summer pool, there is an application deadline by May 1st. Now, let's just say that we wanted to submit an application for the May 1st deadline. We could do so. We could submit it for $6 million, $9 million, whatever it is. That's just getting into their summer pool program. Once we go down the road,
if we put it in for $10 million, can we back
that? Oh, yeah, we can back $5 million easily. It's better to have something in there that's higher, so they kind of have a magnitude of what the project's going to cost. But if once we get the total estimates from the engineers coming back here shortly, we'll have a better idea of what it is. The only downfall is if we don't get an application into the Virginia Resource Authority for May 1, then we are out of luck until the fall. So just as a comparison, so what we also did is, so for the Virginia Resource Authority, we also said, okay, well, if we decide to wait until we go into the fall pool, the only difference is we're going to have more capitalized interest for the current year. So
If the interest rate stays exactly the same now and we go to the fall pool, it's actually a little better. But do you want to take a risk of waiting to the fall pool to get in? Because it's probably unlikely that the rates will be the same as we get to the fall pool. That's why the fall pool one right now looks actually a little better.
The fall pool, the application deadline, if I remember correctly, I think it's August 1, and then that doesn't close until November sometime.
But we're not paying as much interest in that first year as we do on the current option, the summer pool one. But it's unlikely that fall pool one is going to stay that low because the interest rates would likely change. That's what the next column shows.
Yeah, the orange column is basically the fall pool, but the rates go up 50 basis points.
Why do you say it's better? I don't understand why you're saying the fall pool is better than the summer pool.
Well, just on
so
here.
So right here, you have capital, you have more
14
capital
versus 421
the first year.
And the total principal and interest, it's actually lower if you go to the fall pool. It's just because of the way the interest payments are.
It's because you're capitalizing more interest in the current fiscal year, so that makes the total proceeds required higher.
And the investor paid premium is the cost of the financing?
So the investor paid premium, that's what we're going to get above and beyond what our par amount is from the investors.
Oh, okay. So that actually comes back to us.
Yes. That
becomes part of the dollars we actually accrue.
The
it's less than the debt. I mean,
and the investor paid premium
the debt amount
is
less
total
than.
Amount.
It's a discount.
Yeah.
Okay,
well, it's not a discount, it's a premium. The discount would be the opposite, where we would have to.
No, I mean from the.
Yeah.
And you could do this by May 1?
I can get an application.
Oh, you can get it in.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, so I guess the positive with the Virginia Resource Authority is, so since we just did the Virginia Saves program, VRA was a part of that. So there's mm-hmm. a lot of our economic data, financials, all that stuff, they're very familiar with. We obviously, we did the transaction through the VRA for the James River Water Authority. Then even a couple of years ago, we did a refunding on the courthouse and the library debt. We also took out some additional funds for a fire truck, and that was done through the Virginia Resource Authority too. So, one of the pluses is they worked with us and they kind of know our situation. They know we're things that are going on in the county, and they're familiar with our financials and our economics.
And these are based on 20-year bonds rather than 30-year. We've talked about anywhere from 15 to 30, and eyebrows always raise when you're talking about 30.
And then speaking with Wayne, too, Mr. Stevens, disregarding some of this, from his standpoint, it would be better to not go out as far as 30 years, basically, due to the replacement life of some of the equipment and stuff. Obviously, pipes are going to be in the ground for a while, but when you're getting the pumps and all that stuff.
Beyond 30 years, but you'd be okay with 30 years? 25 years?
I would work on 25.
Yeah.
20 to 25 is what we had talked about. So we can always go out and get pricing for 25, but just as on the surface we've talked.
Like, right. And what is the, I'm confused by the VRA fee in that, 12.5 bips is 1.25%, isn't it? So how are they charging 1.25% and still keeping their rate at 3.11? Right there, that is that supposed to be 1.25 or?
That's good. It's going to be in the cost of issuance.
No, 12.5 basis points.
Yeah.
0.125.
0.125.
Yeah.
So BIP is a 0.01 is a BIP, right?
Okay. Yes.
So 10 BIPs is 1%, right?
No.
10 bips is
0.1%.
100 basis points is 1%.
Oh, I see. Okay. So it's 12.5 basis. Oh, okay. So it's not a bip, it's a basis point.
Yeah. 100 basis points is a full 1%. So this is only 12.5 out of 100.
Gotcha. Okay.
So these are just some of the comparisons. So let's kind of go to the next slide. So really, I was just looking for some direction from the board. So one, if the board is interested in doing any type of debt funding for the ZXR project. Secondly, if they're interested in going with the Virginia Resource Authority as a funding source. And then third, if we want to enter the summer pool, and if you say yes to all three of those, then the staff would recommend submitting an application for the summer pool. As I said, the application deadline is May 1. The application does not obligate the county to have to go through and complete the transaction at all. And if the county does go through, there's still many, many formal board approvals that would need to be done. There'd be resolutions.
But it allows us to lock in.
But this gets us
probably a lower rate
for the summer pool.
And if you're going to go in, you might as well go in with what you think the project nominally. $10 million because you can back down to whatever level you want, but go in because you may decide that at 3% you want the whole $10 million from that and use the $4 million as just a pure investment, a longer term investment, or pay off another debt or whatever alternative. But you need to just know what the best use of your dollars are.
Do we have any idea what the 25-year loan would be?
I don't, but I can get that.
I can tell you in a second.
No. Oh, you're just wondering what the debt service amount is? Or just,
no, the rate, the interest rate.
I don't know the rate.
It would be a little higher, but...
That's 3.2 or, you know, 3.... You know,
I think maybe a little higher than that. Yeah. I think probably 3.5.
Well, it'd be good to know the difference. I mean, if you do 25 years and you're getting close to the $6 million, you know. I mean,
we'll give you all those figures. If we get in the pool... If we didn't pull from the line, can we change from 25 to
20? So what we can do, if the board says, let's go ahead and submit an application at the next board meeting, I can give you some more information regarding some comparisons on the 20 and 25, but this way, this allows us to be able to get the application in by the May 1st.
Ms. Eager, what do you think? You want to go ahead and try to get the application done?
I have one question. Yes. If you go ahead and do that application for the VRA, would you also put an application in for the EDA?
No, the EDA, that's something that we would have to go out to rating agencies. We would have to update all the county's information. It's
different process.
So it's simpler to try it with the VRA. Are you guaranteed that you'll get that?
I'm sorry?
Are you confident that you would get that?
The VRA would approve us?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay, then I think you should go ahead and put your application in.
Ms. Booker?
Yes. Put it in for 10
days. Oh, absolutely, yeah.
I mean, well, that's 10. Three yeses already. I think Mr. Weaver agrees to go ahead and look into it, do you, sir?
Yeah.
You can do the full amount and then take less.
Yes, right.
Go. We can put 10 in and then like I said, there's nothing obligated.
And we can always come back. So we can figure out what we want to do.
As an example, the $10 million, you can see on the screen, $10 million at 3.5 for 25 years. The annual debt service would be 606.
Mm-hmm. Right.
If we take that down to 3.1, let's assume it's going to be 3.5 or somewhere thereabouts for 25 years. Let's take it down to 3.1.
I was going to say 3.25.
Take this down to 20 years, and it's 678.
Mm-hmm. They were at 3.2,
Pardon?
I said the effective rate they had in your example here was 3.34, I guess.
That's including all the costs, right. The cost of issuance. And
yeah, which is in.
But we wouldn't calculate based on that. We'd calculate based on the basic interest. But I mean, in any case, it probably doesn't make a lot of sense to go to 25 years to save $72,000 a year. The longer you amortize it out, the more risk you've got of not having dollars to pay for whatever you're going to fix. So if this were a $300,000 difference, then maybe that way, but I'm not sure I'd do it for $72,000.
I can get some rates on both of them and bring back to the May 3rd meeting. As an estimate and the prelim side, put the application in at $10 million at the 3.1% for 20 years, and if we determine that.
What is our earnings rate right now on our investments? What do we have?
Less than 1%.
That's right around 1%.
It's like 0.97.
Really, you take
0.96.
The $3 million, you add the 1% back in, and that's your true cost from that standpoint.
Right.
I mean, if you're investing, if you're betting on interest rates going up, then every time the interest rates go up, you're actually lessening your burden.
Yeah, if you're taking out low debt, but the interest rates are going up, and you've got cash to earn interest on, it's a great situation.
Never gonna
see you got in on the low debt side, but of course, no debt's better. But,
but if you're earning 1% and you're paying 3%, might make more sense to pay.
No, clearly. And that's why I want you to be aware of all the different various options. And I think there's a risk of the county not putting some cash against this project.
Mm-hmm.
Because you set aside about $7 million for the radio project, but then because we got some good rates on the radio project, you move that money over here. Some of it's been spent on a variety of other things. Sooner or later, you're going to end up not putting any cash towards the water project, and you probably ought to put some. I would think, but that's all you guys.
What's the risk on that?
Yep.
So when will we get another report from the finance board?
We did not meet this past month because there was a form that we were waiting for.
We're working to finalize some things.
And the finance board is largely locked in now.
Mm-hmm.
All the as much money as we can possibly put is in interest bearing accounts now,
uh-huh.
And there's a great deal more flexibility on what can go into what pot, and you're going to get as pretty close to maximum mm-hmm. opportunity off those dollars that you could have based on state code,
right?
Because you can't be too risky,
sure.
You know, based on state code.
Mm-hmm.
All righty, thank you very much, Mr. Dahl.
If you adjourn right now, I win.
We will now move to our second round of public comment. Anyone wishing to address the board should come to the podium and state your name and address. Please remember to keep your comments to 5 minutes on topic and direct it to the board. Anyone wishing to speak to the board at this time?
Don't even think of
that. It won't be the first time I've listened to you, son. All right, seeing no one wishing to speak, I will now close the second round of public comment. And moving forward to my next page, I will say anything else for the good of the order. Hearing none, is there a motion to adjourn?
I so moved.
Second?
Second.
Motion made by Ms. Booker, second by Mr. Weaver. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Chair votes aye. I heard a sigh from Mr. O'Brien, so we count that as a yay.
Yeah, that was an aye, yes.